Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history.
Thank you. And now, the Nordic Frontier!
There is no reasonable level of anti-Semitism.
Nordic resistance movement are present.
Greetings, comrades, and welcome back to the Nordic Frontier. It is the final solution to your podcast problem, and we are back from one long hiatus. It's been crazy. It is a National Socialist broadcast, and it is hosted by a member of the Nordic Resistance Movement, and that is I, Andreas, and with me I have Alan. How are you doing, Alan, and how have you been?
Wow, what a break. Yeah, no, real nice. First long vacation in my life. But actually, we were pretty damn busy. Did two episodes of Aristogenesis, remastered some audiobook that we did. What else? Got up to some other stuff. But it's been good. It's just been too damn hot. So What I want you to do is get the Iceland Nest Chief on the phone and tell him I'm moving over.
Oh, yeah. It has been crazy hot. And yeah, in the 30s, you don't get up too much. You're just sweating away. But yeah, the barbarians are back. And have you been breaking any bucks by any chance this summer?
Remind me, what was that supposed to mean?
Oh, you missed the meme. I'm sorry. Oh my God.
There's too many of them. I gotta tell you, I spent as much time off of the internet and any sort of computer stuff for the whole summer.
Yeah.
So I probably missed a million memes.
Yeah, this one, you would have liked to be there for this meme because it is gross. It is this idea that slave owners in North America used to anally rape black slaves.
I've heard of those books.
Yeah, it's a controversial theory, but it's nothing I've been doing this summer, for sure. I've been doing other things.
Is that where they say, boy, you got a pretty mouth? Is that one?
Yeah, it's something like that. I don't know, those people are crazy. Yeah. But it's been going viral, you know, obviously on Twitter. These kinds of things are allowed to trend because they're wholesome, good for the community and all that. Promoting black pride, maybe? I don't know. Is it? Something like that. But it has been a crazy summer. And before we get into anything, I just want to apologize to the whole global community of all these nice, upstanding, white, proud people that I failed the 88 motherfucking burpees challenge. I just want to get that out.
88 burpees. 88 fucking burpees.
Before anyone gets too upset about it, 88 burpees in one set is absolutely insane. That's what we've been finding out. But it's not impossible. It's not impossible. If you put your work into it, I'm sure you can beat it. Alan was close. He has been very diligent. And yeah, do you want to tell us about your experience?
Well, I told you I would try. So here's the thing, and I suppose it doesn't really count, but I got up to 88 inside of a workout session. So my strategy was like, I suck at burpees, so I just put in, you know, 10 in a row, then 20 in a row, and then I would do some abs, and then I would do 10 more, and then lift some weights and do 10 more. And I kept doing that like every workout session, you know, week in and week out, until like inside of like taking those breaks to lift weights, I would get up to 88, and I would just like put more on in between the weights. But the sad thing is I couldn't get up to 44 in one set without taking a break. Mm. It's fucking hard, man. Mm-hmm. It's really difficult. And you have to have, it's like, you got to have a lot of training. It's like cardiovascular, you know, cause yeah. you're huffing after you do 30 in a row, you're whew, shit. Right.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, I think, yeah, you could probably get there, but it's going to take a lot of dedication. I have to say though, it's a really good exercise, and I incorporate, you know, a lot of them in every workout I do. But
yeah, and I mean for a warm up, it's really quick, and it mm-hmm. does its thing for sure. So it's still good for that. I did it daily for a while. And then we had 30 degrees every day for like 2 weeks. And
I just, that's no excuse.
It is an excuse, and I used it. And yeah.
No, I was doing them. I was doing all that like on my balcony in the sun, like beating on me.
Oh my God.
I don't care. Fuck it. I'll just put on some Wagner. I put on some Wagner, and then I just did it in the sun. I don't care.
Yeah, challenging that true Aryan, the barbed Aryan.
Exactly. You're trying.
So nice. So, yeah, I've been doing a lot of chins, and I've done a lot of push-ups. You know, I'm actually bigger than I used to be. I got to say that. So it's not a complete fail. And we have inspired other people to do it. I heard that Shegg, he was up to 50. I saw, and this guy, redacted social nationalist, he says, 76 burpees. That is all pretty right. good. That is very close. I mean, if you reach 88, that's glorious. You're going to be remembered.
I promised that guy he can do it next time, because I was stuck on 70, and then like I got to 75, and then I just pushed it to 88 in the next workout. Mm. So just keep at it.
Yeah, it's good stuff. So as long as you're getting fitter, smarter, healthier, and better white people out there, I'm pretty good with that.
Yeah.
So tonight we have a very special guest. We're going to have story time from Africa with one of our favorite Africans. You know, there are a few good Africans out there, and Jan Lamprecht is definitely one of those guys. And he's good at telling a story. So he's going to talk a little bit about what's going on in South Africa right now. And we're also going to talk about the Congo. It's very exciting. And before that, we're going to go through everything that has happened this summer. In, what do we got, 45 minutes? We're just going to cram all the memes.
All right, 45 headlines. Minutes. Go.
So that we're going to touch on some things that have been big, I think, if I can remember them. It has been crazy, like, I try to tune out. I know you've done a pretty good job tuning out, but I just can't tune out anymore. I'm in the, whatever you call it, the minutia of the headlines that just keep creeping in. And the memes always constantly keep reminding me of how bad it really is, but always trying to keep a smile on it. So we're going to talk about that. Had some experiences with my holiday as well. But we're going to talk about donations first, and we have been getting some. We have been getting a donation from David Palm and from Holger Dritte. So we say,
may the blessing of cheer be upon you.
That is very nice indeed. And if you want to contribute to the Nordic Resistance Movement, you can go to nordicresistancemovement.org and press the donation tab there. you will find the address for our post box, and you can send cash there in the mail. There are also crypto wallet addresses there you can choose. I think Ethereum is doing very well right now. It's just consistently climbing. I think it was 3,300 the other day. That's pretty crazy. I mean, imagine how shocked people were when Bitcoin was, you know, hitting 3,000. Now Ethereum is at 3,000. And I think Bitcoin is around 38,000 now. So it's been pretty stable over summer. And yes, I think we had a letter as well, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, pretty sure. Do you remember when we did the last show? Man, time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah, it's been a while. At least the stream's working. I was worried that it wouldn't work. You take a break and everything breaks down.
Yeah, no, I've troubleshot it yesterday, so it should be pretty good. Yes, we did receive a letter. So I'm going to read this letter. I don't think it's too doxy from David, because it's some information that's interesting for the community. So he says, Andreas and Alan, once again, thank you for all your hard work with the podcast. One thing I wanted to address, and I have heard talked about on the show with Full House, the issue of homeschooling. I was homeschooled as a child, and I agree that it's the best possible way to go at it these times. Homeschooling also requires a lot of effort from both parents, and it is sometimes more of a commitment than a family can handle. I have homeschooled all of my children at some point, but my work and family circumstances do not allow me to do it year after year. Knowing that it was going to be the case, I came up with a counter-indoctrination strategy to prepare my children for what they would be getting into in public schools. With your permission, I would like to share the strategy with you. The first thing I did was to start telling them stories about myself, their mother, uncles, aunts, and grandparents, great-grandparents, etc. These stories were fairly short and had to do with some exciting, dangerous, or interesting thing that had happened to that person. Even the most calm and boring life, I will have three or four of these stories. Any family member that came to my house had to tell the children a story about when they were little. My reason for doing this was to give my children a sense of family identity, to make them feel that they were part of a family that has its own history and culture, and help them strongly identify with the other members of the family. The next thing I did was to read stories to them. I have a lot of girls, so fairy and folk tales were popular. Most people know about Hans Christian Andersen and the Grimm brothers, but there are websites for European folk tales that have 30 or 40 folk stories from every European nation. As I read them, I would ask them if they could tell the difference between the stories of each country. Eventually, some of my children have become too old for fairy tales, and now we have moved on to audiobooks. At nighttime, before bed, or on longer car rides, they're listening to books that I have selected for them. I obviously have history that I am trying to teach them with every book that I select, but they do not know this yet. All they know is that they are constantly listening to good stories, and a constant question in the car or in the evening is, can we listen to some Audible? A recent example of what I'm trying to do is when my two oldest children's school started to teach them about slavery in social studies class, I started them listening to Gone with the Wind. It's a great book that covers both history of the American South and drops a lot of red pills about the NIGGERS. I would talk to them every few days, ask them about the story, and try to low-key reinforce the points that I wanted them to take away from it. By the way, thank you for your recommendation of Ronja and the Robber's Daughter. All of my children liked it. So yeah, I'm going to stop there. It's quite a lengthy letter, but I thank you very much for that insight, and I think it's a great idea to have, it's kind of like your own family mythology that you're creating with these small tales. I remember my parents always telling me stories about, well, our family, but also about family members of other families in the village. So if you're part of a small village where you know everybody, it becomes this village mythology where everyone knows even other families' history. But each family will have their own, obviously, perspective on the whole thing. So it's interesting to hear different people's opinions about stuff. But that's how you create this memory of family. And I think it's a really nice idea. What do you think, Galen?
Sounds like a really good strategy. And it's, well, it's kind of weird to say strategy because it's just really very wholesome. It's what you ought to do. I hope to do that one day soon in the future. And I do remember something, might have even mentioned it before, but one of your guys I met, and I asked him, like, how do you handle everything with your children? He said, I just tell them who they are. Mm. And it's that kind of stuff that really sticks with me. And it sounds like that's what people have sort of figured out, like this gentleman, as well as one of the Nest guys and also yourself. It just seems like very natural. But sometimes when you ask that question to yourself, maybe it doesn't occur to you that it can be that simple. I guess it's just in my head, the step after that is making sure that they know they're part of an extended family, right? And we know what that is. So
yeah,
that's really nice.
It is really nice. And I should have had the Master Race drop loaded. I don't have it tonight because he donated the Swedish Master Race currency. And you should have a very nice thank you for that as well. And if you haven't tuned in before, we do appreciate if you can exchange your currency for Swedish kroner before you send it off. But if you can't, if it's very hard to get by, send your currency of choice and we'll make do. But it is easy to just be able to use the money right off the bat, because going to the bank with five different currencies, they don't like that. So, yeah. We can maybe move into some of the content for this evening. And we should have one of these, I think.
This is Sven Longshanks from RadioAlbion.com, and you're listening to The Nordic Frontier. The final solution to your podcast problems.
Indeed you are. It is the final solution, and you have arrived. So a lot of stuff has happened this summer. There's been a lot of COVID shit. We're not going to cover any COVID shit tonight. We'll save that for next time and try to get to the kind of the trends where this thing is moving, because it's not going to stop, man. This is a train ride that's not going to stop. So we're gonna figure that out maybe next week. For now, we're going to talk about a little bit what the movement has been up to. And now my browsers are playing funny with me. As per usual. Here we go. I'm going to pull it up on the browser for the video audience. There it is. So there was this story about one of our prominent members, Tobias Lindberg, that kind of went viral, because it had to do with firearms. People really like their guns. So there has been this long ordeal in the movement where the powers that be, the Swedish government, has continuously pushed the envelope when it comes to carrying guns. And they want to disarm the Swedish people. That is very clear. And they use petty methods to do it. And one of the petty methods they do is the National Reserve, and I think I mentioned this before, some of the members of the National Reserve, these are people that did their army duty and they signed up to be volunteers, they got to keep their service weapon in their home because they're always on reserve duty. And they started taking those weapons back a few years ago. And they have put restrictions on hunting. and owning weapons and hunting equipment. Now they are proposing you need a license to own magazines. And the quirkiness of that, what makes it like complicated is that, yeah, sure, if you have a license, then you like, you own the weapon. Why does it matter if you need a license for a magazine? You're never going to walk around with a magazine without a weapon. Well, you're only entitled to a number of firearms. I think it's 5. I might be wrong. Might be 3 per person. Might be able to be extended. Well, let's say it's 5. And let's say you're into guns. So you got 2 different hunting rifles. You got a shotgun and you got like a more of a sniper rifle. And you also need a license for a suppressor. So you might want to be putting a suppressor on your long range. And then you got 3 licenses just there. And then what if you're into some pistol shooting, like professionally or as a hobby? Then you need another license for that. And then imagine if you need a license for all your magazines. That's how they would squeeze you, I think, with that kind of ruling. But that's just to show you that they're constantly concerned with us owning too many weapons for some reason, as if it's a problem that people have hunting equipment in their homes and it's not just Mohammed getting their Eastern European AK-47s delivered straight off the boat. Like, no one's checking these borders anyway. So the legal weapons are never the problem. That's the point. So what they've done to members in our movement is that they have deemed us like the secret police without making it an official policy or anything, has had statements where they're suggesting that we might be a terrorist organization or we might just be a criminal gang, like one or the other. But the organization is somehow criminal without being convicted in court or having, you know, any kind of legal precedent for that kind of statement. That's what they refer to us when they're accusing us of, when they're trying to take our guns. So in this case of Tobias Lindberg, he is unconvicted. He is he hasn't been convicted of anything in his entire life. So there hasn't been any misconduct when he's carried his weapons. He's been doing hunting, and there's no bad history there. But one day they just decided that they're going to confiscate his weapons. And they've done this to numerous amounts of levels, but he decided to fight back. So he went to the first tier of court, and they decided in their verdict that the main reason for taking the weapons was that, let's just read here for the audio audience. Because of Tobias' membership in the Nordic Resistance Movement, the police claimed that he was part of a violent extremist movement in which the weapons could be misused. So notice, he hasn't misused the weapons, but the movement itself could pressure him into misuse the weapons, or, you know, they could get into the wrong hands or whatnot. The police
have used future crime?
Yes, it is future. It's like pre-crime shit. The police have used this line of reasoning against many law-abiding gun owners in the Nordic Resistance Movement who've had their weapons confiscated over the last few years. However, Tobias did not accept the police decision and successfully took the case to the Sweden's highest court. So, this is where we have a point in, it's point 9 in our political program, where we say that the courts should be ruled by educated lawyers. And this is what we're talking about in that point, is that political adversaries, like political opponents, are sitting in the courts on the lower tiers, in the tingsrätt, which is the first tier, and then the court of appeals. So you have politicians judging him in a political case, because he hasn't misused his weapon in any way. So they're already decided that, you know, he's not eligible to own weapons. So they're just going to take them away from him. And they took the weapons before he went to court. That's also an interesting thing. They confiscate the weapons without, you know, any kind of oversight.
Yeah, they have no cause, no warrant, or anything like that, so to speak.
They'll just show up, take them. So he went to court, and he went to the Court of Appeals, and he went to the highest instance, the highest court with this case. An interesting thing there is that they have actual educated people in law, and they look at the details. They look at the case, and they're like, how can we make sense out of this? So here it says, after having lost all previous instances, the Supreme Administrative Court, which has the final say on such matters, ruled in Tobias's favor. In their verdict, the HFD wrote that Tobias's appeal had focused on the fact that the police had been completely unable to specify how he was personally unfit to own firearms. Furthermore, the HFD wrote the following concerning the legal basis of the case. The reasoning for revocation of the reasonable cause primarily concerns circumstances attributable to a character of the defendant and his ability to take care of his weapon. And then they go on. The HFD subsequently wrote that Sweden has a fundamental law that guarantees freedom of speech. Really? Freedom of demonstration. Really? And freedom of assembly to its citizens. I don't recognize this. I think they're mistaken. I think
sounds like I don't know, maybe Holland or something. Maybe they can do that over there.
Yeah, we've spent the last 4.5 years on this podcast proving that this is bullshit. So yeah. I think they're sadly mistaken. But any case, it wrote the following about these freedoms. Oh my God, they're on the high horse here. The freedoms give a person the right to express opinions, participate in demonstrations, and be a member of organizations without interference of reprisals or reprisals. Permission to own a firearm can therefore not be revoked merely on the basis of a person's views, membership of a political organization, or participation in meetings and manifestations arranged by that organization. So that all sounds very good. But it's obvious they're reading from the book. Like, they've actually looked at what it says, so he can't be convicted of this. And he has now gotten his weapons back. And we have news of other members getting their firearms back. And now members of the Nordic Resistance Movement can once again apply for a hunting license so that they can own their own weapons because of this verdict. I think it's absolutely amazing. This is changing history in Sweden. So
yeah, they can't just do blanket political repression.
No, because now we have a precedent. Like, you just point to this. This is the highest court. This is what we're going to go with. So unless you are misusing your legally owned weapon, you are allowed to carry them. So there are a few hurdles, of course. The weapons are not for self-defense. Like, in the American Constitution, you're supposed to shoot your political tyrants. That's not what our weapons are for. They're for hunting moose and maybe some geese. But you're not supposed to shoot anyone. You know, even if they invade your home and rape your family, you're not allowed to shoot them. You're going to go to prison fucking ASAP.
So yeah, you don't have the castle doctrine or anything like that.
No. I don't know. What's that one?
I think it was in Virginia, maybe some other state, if I'm maybe mistaken. But basically, somebody, you can defend your home. So someone breaks in, you can shoot them.
Yeah.
It's like, your home is your castle, that's your land, and you can tell people to get the hell off of it.
Yeah.
And you can shoot. I think this is what that like South Park episode was about, maybe 10 years ago, where Cartman started drawing like chalk lines on the street and threatening people.
Okay.
It's really old, but yeah, they make fun of people who like guns and take that stuff seriously.
That's how it always was in the States. Subversive KIKESs.
It's funny. People in America, they're always like, yeah, but we shouldn't have guns because in Europe, they don't have any crime and they don't have guns. So why should we have them? Maybe we won't have any crime. It's like, no, you have crime because we have a shit ton of Mexicans and Negroes shooting everyone up and making everything unsafe. That's why you have gun crime. You're just too stupid to figure it out.
Yeah. Everyone just uses Switzerland as the perfect example. They have, you know, they have more weapons per capita than any other country, and they have a very low crime rate. That is changing, though, gradually because of mass immigration, and they're also fighting for them to be more restrictive with their gun ownership. So it is going the same trend. Like, guns are bad, but we have more guns than ever in society killing people. I think, you know, it's just such bullshit. It's like, drugs are bad, but we have more drugs in society than we've ever had. We have more high people, more addicts, more shit people walking around. No one's concerned about that. Now we have to take away the legal weapons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so these people, they're not the brightest, and they're not poking at the right places. That's what I'm thinking. So, yeah, it's very good news. And the article also finishes up by pointing out that we have had some other, like, glorious victories, legal victories, last year and the year before, actually, that is also going to be, you know, used as precedents in other court cases where they're trying to ban us once again and failing miserably. So, very good news, and we hope for the best. So the next one that I had was this one. I just wanted some clout. I'm clout collecting, clout harvest. And this time it's because the Jews were on, what was that, Etsy? Some Etsy shops that had...
They're selling dreidels? What are they doing?
No.
Clay dreidels, man.
Let's see here. In June, it was late June, that over 100,000 people have signed this petition to prevent Disney from copyrighting the Nordic gods, Loki, Thor, and Odin. And this is after, I believe it was Etsy shops. It doesn't say in this short article. But it was basically Etsy shops that were selling, I don't know, embroideries and, you know, pictures, anything, you know, depicting the gods, using their names, stuff like that. But they had it in the tags. So Disney was basically hoovering up all these tags and just reporting these accounts for using these characters. And I don't know if there was the exact Disney characters. It might be the case, but still, it's pretty disgusting. And the reason why I want to collect clout is because I said just a few months before this happened that we should sue the Jews for copyright infringement because they're using our gods in their disgusting cartoons, you know, and they're subverting them and making them black and all shit. So not only are they infringing on the copyright, they're also misrepresenting, you know, quite extensively. Oh, yeah. You know, Heimdall, he is described as a blonde as a blonde god in the Edda. So yeah, that's on purpose. I don't know if you noticed. I had to explain that to my son the other, I don't know, it was a few months ago now. It's like, they made him black in the show, and yeah, he's not black. Let's just leave it at that. And the Rainbow Bridge, the rainbow, you know, it's a beautiful thing. It's the Rainbow Bridge. That's what it is. That's what he guards and all that stuff. So, I don't know. Did you miss this one, or did you catch it before your hiatus?
No, I think I saw some petition, just like a general petition, some like change.org, where it just was circulating online to push back against Disney. And I don't know the details of it, like if it's going to turn into anything, right? It's going to be used in some way, or someone was trying to lawyer up about it. But yeah, it's pretty egregious thing to do, to say that, like, well, no, we have these characters. Well, no, they're not characters. They belong to people and cultures. They're not yours because you got them from somewhere. You didn't pull them out of your ass, right? You pull Black Panther out of your ass, and he's a shitty character. But apart from that, you kind of borrowed a lot of that stuff. So, you know.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, it's like a new prediction. They will copyright Jesus next, you know. We'll see. I don't know. Have they already done that, maybe? Maybe they're working on that.
You'd think they would because, you know, it's it's kind of, you know, written by Saul of Tarsus, and he's a Jew, so they could have already done that, but I guess they didn't really care to.
That's right. That's some inflammatory Christian lore, the Saulus, Paulus. That's right. So, yeah, I think they would do that. They would just make Jesus one of these action heroes. He would walk on water and create bread. And
Yeah. This sort of reminds me of, what was it? You ever see this movie UHF? It was like a Weird Al Yankovic thing from the 80s. And they made this thing. They were doing all these different movie trailers, and they had one called Gandhi 2.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone should just look that up after the show just to have a little laugh before they go to bed. Gandhi 2.
Yeah, that sounds good. So, yeah, I had a little tale that I wanted to talk about that I found peculiar when I was on my time off. We've had a lot of time with the family. People might have followed along on Tiva's Comfy Corner. There has been some building projects. This is the office now. I don't know if you can see that on the camera. I got a very, very constricted camera angle because it's not finished yet. So it's a work in progress, but I've got the actual room done. And it's kind of completed the living room outside, actually. It really tied the room together, as Big Lebowski would say. And we made a pantry as well, walk-in pantry. I mean, that's amazing stuff. Like,
that's some high-class business there.
Yes, having to deal with cupboards, you know. Jesus Christ, I think I've got a drop for that in a while there.
Jesus Christ, there's a fucking Jew in the cupboard.
Man. So I had to get the stuff out of the cupboards because there were so many Jews in there. So I made a new cupboard, and it's a walk-in pantry, and it's just like when you come home from shopping, and, you know, when your wife comes home from shopping, obviously, it's a hassle to put stuff in cupboards, you know, it's tight, you have to move things around, you know, just create a really big space, and the next time you have panic shopping, or if you're just bunkering up, you know, you can just put it, just stack it on the shelves all the way to the ceiling. Crazy room in there, and it will also keep cool, you know, it's in a cool corner. This house is not very well insulated, so it gets a really nice breeze in the corners of the house.
So you got one of those holes in the wall. I remember that when I lived in Stockholm, we had this old ass apartments, and like one of the sort of like fake refrigerators is just, it has a hole in
it's
the
a
wall,
hole in so wall.
It gets all the cold air into it. You can just keep a ton of stuff there in the winter, and it's just this like wooden cabinet with a hole in the wall.
Yes,
goes directly outside through the concrete.
Yeah, that was my father's tip because he built one himself. Yeah. So nice. Just to have that, and you know, close it if it's getting too cold, but you can have it open to cool off your stuff, and you know, you can keep potatoes in there on the floor in the dark all like winter. Well, we have a cold cellar as well. It's not fully restored, so I'm not using it yet, but you can keep stuff like carrots and potatoes down there all winter, so that's pretty nice. But for the cupboard, for the cans and stuff like that, really nice. So some quality Lebensraum, finished the staircase as well. I think that was posted. That's a work in progress. We've been working on the staircase since we started working on the upstairs like 6 years ago. And it was finally painted. Now it's just done. And when I think about what we've done with this house, and I'm not going to be too doxy, but if people would see the pictures from when we came here and saw the house, it was not livable space. There was no water. There was half the house had electricity. And the upstairs was just sawdust and logs. There was nothing up there. So just thinking back on the work that I've done on this house just makes me, I get like anxiety just thinking of having to do it again. Because it's so much fucking work. And I've forgotten half of it. I just look at a corner of the house sometimes and I'm like, my God, that wall was crazy. You know, I know what's back there. I never want to see that stuff again. You know, you get like flashbacks from the trauma. But now it's just, now it's almost done. Like this, you know, we can redo the kitchen for sure. The kitchen was a haphazard, cool. Like we just slopped that together to be able to live here. So that can be redone, but at least it's functioning. The water's running. That's all I care about. So that has been a journey. And yeah, people can follow along on the Tiva's Comfy Corner if they want to see the pictures of the improvements, stuff like that. So, and it's also that feeling that we wanted when we moved here, that we have done everything ourselves. Like every centimeter of the inside of this house has been created by us, and we have chosen everything ourselves. And that's not, you don't get that feel from a concrete box. And I never felt at home in that environment from renting and all that stuff. So that's what I wanted when I finally bought my own place, that we would build everything ourselves, except for the things that we require professionals, like you know, drawing the pipes and laying the carpet in the bathroom. That's also very important that that's properly done, sealed and all that stuff. But other than that, everything is done by us. And the electrics, of course, but that's not it. Aesthetics. So that's nice. And I just remembered when I was talking about it with someone, I was showing some stuff. And I told him about the bathroom when we moved in, or when I came here. I spent a whole year building the downstairs before we moved in. So every day in the summertime, I would ride my bike to this house and just work all day, like 9 hours a day. Dang. And then ride my bike home and then come back the next day. Eating tuna and one can of mackerel in tomato sauce and egg and a cup of coffee every day
for months. That's hardcore.
Yeah. And the toilet when we moved in. The guy who had this house before us, he fucked everything up. This is a beautiful house. It's almost 200 years old. So it has a really nice backbone in it. The logs are of, you know, insane proportions. Really nice stuff. And the guy was just fucking everything up with everything that he was doing in here. So we tore that all out. But what he did to the bathroom was he had half done it. He had put up plasterboards on the walls. And he had been showering in there. Just what? Showering alone. And then months after, when we got the house, it was just mold. The fucking entire bathroom was just mold. It's like, what the fuck were you thinking, man? So we obviously, I had to tear the walls out. I had to tear the ceiling out. I had to tear the whole floor out, except the beams. And I made new beams next to the old beams as well to make it extra sturdy. And, you know, that's the kind of stuff that he was doing. Like, and Every time he would tear something out, like, oh, this guy thought that a wall would look nice here. Okay, think again. I'm going to tear this wall down. Oh, this wall is attached to this. Okay, I'll have to take that down. Oh, there's some electrics there. Okay, I'll have to pull that out. You know, it's just a never-ending tale of fucking redoing everything. So, yeah, it has been an epic journey. And we're almost there. And it's always nice. I always get builder's fatigue. And now I'm like, oof, I just can't do anything anymore. There's lists. Lists need doing in there.
Yeah.
And list. People don't know in English what list is. But skirting boards and what would you call the boards in the ceilings? Ceiling boards?
I am not the guy to ask about that. We'll just go with ceiling boards.
Maybe the building guys. The a high testo.
I was supposed to be paying attention when I was young, but I wasn't. So now I don't know what ceiling boards are called.
Well, it's the skirting boards for the ceilings. That's what I like, I call them lists because that's what we say in Swedish. So I just call them lists. They're always lists. It's around the doors, in the ceiling, on the floor. It's all lists. In the corners, it's lists.
I'm going to use that word then. That's my new word.
It's a list. It's a long list of Jews. No, that's something else.
That's Biden's cabinet.
Yo, snap. That was just extended. We might get into that as well. Jesus Christ, new anti-Semitism committee. God damn it. Lipstadt haunting us once again. So I had another tale of that I might bring up briefly. I was going to blog about it, but I'll just briefly summarize it with saying that we traveled the inland of Sweden on the way down to a place called Lycksele, which is the first semi-big town that you'll come across on the inland from where I am. And there is nothing in the inland, and I haven't really thought about it before, but there's literally nothing there. You drive through forest and deforested forest and then more forest. Some lakes, yeah, they look pretty good. And some mountains. There was a lot of mountains because you're getting close to Norway and it's getting more mountainous as you're approaching the border. So it's quite beautiful, but very depopulated or unpopulated. And you get to thinking, like, what do people do when they live out there? Like, obviously it's a tranquil existence. But what do you do for a living? And where do you get your your biscuits, you know, when you go shopping? And we came to Lycksele and we thought that, you know, this is a biggish town. It's not that big. I think 40,000, 50,000. It's a small town. Might actually pull that up later. But there is this famous, it's the northernmost animal park there that you can go to, and it has all the Nordic animals. That's what it's pride. So I hate animal parks. I just have to say that, and I think I mentioned it on the show before. Like animals in captivity, because I'm not a big pet fan either. You know, I like animals in the wild, and if they're going to be pets, they better perform some sort of service, like murder mice. Or, you know, like, lay
then,
eggs.
Then you know why you have it around, right?
Yeah, lay eggs or make meat for me. Like, it's not that I'm cold and hate animals. It's just that animals should be free in the wild. And otherwise, it should just serve our purposes because we're the ones domesticating them. So we did that for a reason. That's what I think. And it's also great for children. I would say for children, pets are really nice so that they can be around animals. It's great for allergies that they grow up around animals so that they get some good bacteria and all that stuff. But we went there to look at these animals, and they have some of the, you know, our predators like the lynx and the wolverine, you know. It's not as cool as the Marvel comic.
Yeah, they're going to copyright his ass.
Yeah, copyright the fucker. Yep, that's right. It's just a big C on him when I looked at him. I was going to take a photo. It's just big Jewish copyright straight in his face. No, and I didn't like taking photos either because, you know, taking photos through the fence at captive predators is just so depressing. So yeah. I just, you know, I went along for the ride. It's good for the kids to get to see the animals. And we got to see all the animals there. They had bear as well. That's pretty nice for them to see bear. So rarely do you see bear in the wild here. But otherwise, we've seen most of the animals just living here, looking out the window. You get reindeer, you get deer, you get fox, you get snake, you get rabbits and hares and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And, yeah, so that was nice. But the staff at this place was interesting because it's obviously a summer place, so they have summer people working there. And it was a lot of musky-looking fellas working there. So they were basically, it looked like they were running the place because there were so many of them walking around. But obviously, there were some trained, because this is not any other job. Like, they're taking care of animals, and serious things can happen at this animal park that needs professional attention. So there was obviously, like, I can imagine, like, a childminder, you know, bringing these people around, showing them where to use the broom and all that stuff, and where to park the little vehicles they had, all that stuff. So I'm like, God damn it. This is a town in the middle of... I just drove through absolutely nothing for hours. And here we are in this town in the inland of Sweden, and it's just full of racial strangers. And what? We come to this this camping resort. We did some glamping. Do you know glamping?
No.
Glamping is when you're camping, but it's too glamorous to be called clamping. Or clamping. It's
is this too, like an Instagram hashtag? It sounds like an Instagram hashtag.
Yeah, it's something. Something to do with women, I'm sure. But it was a really posh camping site where they have, you know, the poshest caravans and all this, you know, family business where people pay a lot of money. And we show up there in our skanky car with a tent. We sit next to these people. I love it. And they had a really nice beach there that you could go down with the kids in the evening or, you know, when you were done with your daily adventures. And, yeah, there was a lot of racial strangers at the beach. And I'm like, this is a really posh resort. I'm turning into one of these people that are, like, advocating for gated communities. Like, can we just have this one nice beach? Can't they go to the other public beach where they can be?
How the hell did they get all the way up there? They shouldn't even know about a place like that.
No.
They should be... Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Stay in Malmo, make kebab.
Yes, and these people were fresh off the boat. I looked at them, like these Biafra, you know, that you see on the posters. Those kinds of Africans were hanging out there. And I don't know, I just felt like, yeah, they wouldn't be there unless someone put them there. That's what went through my mind. And
yeah,
they're socially, they're socially polluting everyone's time here. With their stuff, like people innately know this because they're louder, you know, they do their thing and they come en masse, and that's because you're not allowed to close off beaches in Sweden. Like, lakefronts are open for the public. That's why since years back they have banned building houses next to a lake. So it's very sought after to buy a property that's next to a lake already, then you're allowed to own it, but you're not allowed to build 100 meters from the lake, at least. So, and you're not allowed to block lakes off from the public. So that's why they're there. That's why they're just walking in through this posh campsite and then sitting down at the beach. And another thing is that they have these really posh amenities with cooking facilities and TVs and shit. Obviously, we didn't use any of the stuff. We're camping, you know. We're in the wild over here.
You gotta make the fire yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we made a fire. No, we didn't. You know, then you have these access cards, you know, these private access cards into the facilities because they're so posh. And if we didn't have locked facilities, these people would just wander in there and steal all the shit, obviously.
Yeah, okay, yeah, sure. Yeah.
So just another time, just one more time, or another instance where we could have a nice time, but we can't. We have to have access cards to these places because these people don't belong here. I mean, obviously, they have beaches in Uganda. Pretty sure there's beaches in Congo. We're going to have a look at Congo. Sure, there were some beaches over there. But they had to come to Lycksele, Swedish inland, and be there. And that's when I said, hashtag, I don't know if you know about this hashtag. It's absolutely appalling. There's racists on the internet that say nigger fatigue. You know?
Really?
Yeah. So I was appalled.
And they ended in an ER, like it's the worst version of the
word.
It's
not
the like
hard R. Yes.
Oh, that's the slave master spelling. Oh, no.
Yeah, I have heard this on the internet, and I was appalled. So I had to tweet it, or I don't tweet anymore. I had to Telegram post it, just to make people aware that this is a thing. But that's also kind of how I felt when I was there. I was like, this is my holiday, and you fucking ruined it. Thanks, Jews. All right. Do you have any tales from the trough where you've been? Did you want to get off your chest before we invite John?
Well, I mean, I always have nigger fatigue, so there's nothing new there. I'm trying to go to town, just try to pick up something special from there. And it's all around. So that's always ever present. Nah, I'm just kind of spent a lot of time outdoors in random forests around here and just enjoying that, and did the gayest thing ever, according to Nestor. Mm-hmm. You all know Nestor from Aristogenesis, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
I told I was late to one of our meetings I was supposed to have with him. He said, what's going on? Why are you late? I said, it was taking my cat hiking. He's like, what? Shit ever. What are you doing? I was like, come on, man. You don't understand. I'm training the next
generation of the cat.
No, yeah, exactly. But this is for National Socialist purposes. You don't understand. Like, this, let's get this straight. That shit is not gay. Like, this cat's going up mountains and shit.
Yeah. You're gonna,
he's sniffing for rats.
You're going to be the one that herded the cats. It's going to be
exactly
insurmountable feat, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's nice. All right, so we'll have a little short break here, and we'll bring in Jan and have his takes on what's going on in South Africa. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
We're back from that short music break, and I apologize for the volume. That was me booming because I couldn't turn the volume down just for us, because I haven't set that up properly. So I had to turn it down so we could have a little pre-talk. That's all. So if I hurt your ears with turning it up again, I apologize for that. But we're back. That was a very beautiful music piece from the remnants of a farm in South Africa, where they took everything except the piano, because what would they do with a beautiful piano, right? What would they do? So we got John Lamprecht back on the show. Welcome back.
Hi there. It's an honor to be back on your show again.
It is very nice to have you. We're going to have story time from Africa. We're going to get cozy, get a cup of tea, and enjoy these fantastic tales. I'm actually very fascinated with Africa. I feel like things could have been different. That's what I feel about Africa, that it's not a coincidence that things look the way they look today, all the chaos and all that stuff. All the brutal mass slaughtering that's been going on there, it has been orchestrated. And we've spoken before about who's been orchestrating this. But today we're going to dive into another example of when they came there and orchestrated in the Congo, the Belgian Congo, which we briefly discussed in another episode you were with us. So now you've done a video on that. I've linked that in the show notes if people want to check that out. But I think we're going to start with talking about what is going on in South Africa, because it has been a month or a month and a half ago when there was some drama, maybe a month ago. We had Boer Jack on the Swedish show called the Nordic Radio Nordfront. He did the first half of the show, like an hour interview there, while it was going on. So we had a little while it was going on update on stuff that was going on in Durban and other places around there. So now it's died down, or I don't know your estimate of what's going on, but it's... It will be interesting hearing about your perspective. So how has it been in South Africa, and how are you doing down there?
Hi there, Andreas. Well, everything is quietened down now. The main stuff happened from about just before the middle of July. In total, it ran over a period of 9 days, but there were some days that were more quiet than others. The wildest stuff took place over a period of about 3 days that centered on about the 12th of July. And it's now quiet. Things are finished. They've been hunting the criminals, etc. But the really wild stuff started round about the 9th of July. And it had to do with the arrest of Jacob Zuma, who was the former president of South Africa. He was the president prior to the current president. And all of this violence that's taken place, is directly related to the arrest of Zuma. The Zuma story is a fascinating story. And in a nutshell, this is the most exciting political event that's happened in South Africa, or in Southern Africa, since Robert Mugabe seized the farms of the whites in the year 2000. This is the greatest thing that's happened since then. And I'm very excited by what I'm seeing here, because this is the beginnings of something huge. And I will explain more about that for you. You see, you must understand that South Africa under black rule is a one-party state, and it's been ruled by a political party known as the ANC, the African National Congress. But the African National Congress was a peaceful thing that started more than 100 years ago, and it was to negotiate with whites. But it was hijacked by communists, including the Jew-friendly communist Nelson Mandela. So the ANC later became the political organization
for a race war against the whites. That's what it basically boiled down to. And the ANC, Jews were involved in the creation of the military wing of the ANC. Blacks were involved. Blacks and Jews basically created the military wing of the ANC, which is known as Umkhonto we Sizwe, which we refer to it as MK, the letters MK. So you've got a political wing called the ANC, a military wing called MK, and the Soviets mainly were behind these things in terms of military training, armaments, etc. But into the ANC and its military wing, they started bringing all the different tribes of South Africa. Now, South Africa's got about 9 different tribes, and they tried to bring in coloreds, and they brought in Indians, and Indians are a very important piece of what happened, what went down last month. So basically, the ANC and its armed wing became the single place where everybody who was the enemy of the whites gathered together. And so liberals and communists and Jews and blacks and Indians and even some coloreds, they all functioned inside this thing that was fighting against the whites. But there are some inside stories to this. And one of the inside stories is that the ANC is actually controlled to a large degree by a specific tribe known as the Khoisas. The Khoisas are a tribe from the southeastern part of South Africa. And they're a pretty large tribe, but they're not the largest. The largest is the Zulus. Now, the Zulus lived further to the north. The main black areas in South Africa were all along the coast, along the east coast. So you had the Zulus in the north and the Khoisas in the south. But when it came to fighting the whites now, the Khoisas dominated this political organization, and Zulus were not really in there. Do you know that the West German government in the 1960s, looking at South Africa, they decided to sponsor a Zulu prince by the name of Buthelezi? They were hoping that they could take these warrior-like Zulus and turn them into pro-Western, anti-communist blacks who would one day rule South Africa. So for quite a time, the Zulus were not interested in communism, and the Zulus were not interested in the ANC. However, what took place was that at a point in time, there was a Zulu who joined the ANC by the name of Jacob Zuma. And Jacob Zuma moved up in the structures of the ANC. And even though he was a Zulu in this Khoisa-dominated organization, he actually was so loyal to the communist cause and to the cause of the ANC that alone he moved higher and higher up in the ranks as a lone Zulu in this Khoisa organization. And it was through this Jacob Zuma that Zulus actually started to enter and support this communist organization. So Zuma is a very important person. He alone is responsible for bringing the majority of Zulus into the ANC ruling party. So the whites did try to use some of the Zulus against the other Zulus. There was even a civil war where the whites gave Zulus weapons and the Zulus clashed with the ANC. All these things took place in the past. But when white power ended and the blacks were in charge, the Zulus as a whole then voted for the ANC. Now, when Nelson Mandela became the Prime Minister of South Africa, what then happened was that he had 2 vice presidents. The one was a guy called Mbeki, who I think was a Khoza. I think Mbeki was a Khoza. And the other one was Zuma. So after Mandela did his short stint as the president of South Africa, and he now stepped out of politics, Mbeki became the president of South Africa. And his vice president was this Zulu named Zuma. So all looked good and everything was functioning fine. And at that same time, that was when Robert Mugabe started driving out the whites from Southern Africa, from the farms in Zimbabwe. Now, shortly after that took place, I was following the politics and I noticed something very strange starting to happen. I can't remember the exact year. It was like around about 2007, 2008. A very strange thing started happening in the politics. But before I mention that, I mustn't forget to tell you this story. When I started African Crisis and I was doing stuff about Zimbabwe, and I'd been going for a short while and I had no contacts, nobody really took notice of me, etc. One day I was contacted by some young Zulus. The young Zulus wanted to meet me, and these young Zulus then we had some meetings, and the young Zulus told me that they were very impressed with the political opposition in Zimbabwe against Mugabe. So they told me that they wanted to do a similar thing in South Africa. And the young Zulus told me an interesting story. The young Zulus said to me that no Zulu can ever become the president of South Africa. I said to them, really? They said they even used the word conspiracy. They said there's a conspiracy and no Zulu will be allowed to be the president of South Africa. I said to them, oh, okay. And they said that is why they wanted to start their own political party. Anyway, I helped them a bit. I was still very new. The whole thing was a flop and we parted company. But I never forgot that story that those young Zulus told me. So later now, I wasn't aware at that time about Zuma. But anyway, I noticed later this thing of Mbeki starting to make moves on his vice president, Zuma. And I was probably the only person among the whites on the internet who even noticed what was going on. And I began to realize, look at this. This president has got a mission to destroy his vice president. He's going to try and get rid of him. And I followed all the various weird things that happened, all kinds of friends of Zuma that were also being brought out into the light. Some of them were Indians. I remember one guy was called Shabir Sheikh. Anyway, they started moving in on this Zuma character. And the next thing you knew, the president of South Africa actually fired the vice president. And I watched the whole thing. And I think they were also hitting him with corruption and stuff back then. And we're talking 2008 or so. Anyhow, as this was going down, I was writing commentaries about this. I was fascinated by this because here was a major power thing happening in the ruling party that's against us. But I noticed a very fascinating thing that once Zuma was fired, I noticed hardcore communists starting to come out from other organizations and starting to back Zuma. And there's a trade union known as COSATU, which is the most powerful of the trade unions. And the leader of that trade union was a guy called Vavi. And Vavi went and he said, we're going to put Zuma in as the next president. In the meantime, the liberals and the Jews and the whites and all the wealthy, nobody was taking notice of this. But I followed this and I could see, you know, this Vavi guy, he's a guy who's, he's got power. He means business. Anyway, the ANC has an annual meeting in December, and the ANC had its annual December conference. And at that conference, these communists, because remember, communism is closely intertwined with all of this. Okay. So ANC, black nationalists, communists, they're all working together. Anyway, at this conference in December, liberals and Jews never saw what was coming. These blacks had met and they all did their thing. And the next thing you knew was the ANC has got a very strange rule that Eastern European communists have in their political parties. And it's a rule that allows the political party to recall the president. So the next thing you know is the president has fired his vice president. The political party that he is a member of has its own high-level meeting. And at the high-level meeting, they decide we're going to remove the president from power. And the next thing is they recall the president of South Africa and they take the vice president, the guy who's just been fired, and they make him the president. And that knocked the liberals and the Jews for a six. Nobody saw that coming. And that is how this Zuma becomes the president of South Africa in 2009. So now, of course, the Jews are loving the ANC. They're loving Mandela. By the way, did you know that Nelson Mandela, in his early days, he was an attorney and he worked for a Jew. There are even photographs of Nelson Mandela with his Jewish boss. Sorry?
I'm a Jew?
Just play my bites. Whenever you mention Jews, I play my Jew bites.
Okay. Let me just get my
sorry to put you off there.
I apologize.
he was a lawyer and he had some Jew friends.
Yes. Okay. So anyway, the Jews were always, they always liked Mandela. They loved Mandela. They loved Mbeki. So you had the liberal mass media and the rich all talking nicely, the white rich and the Jewish rich, all talking nicely about the ANC until Zuma. It's still the same political party. All the same actors are there. But suddenly this Zulu is in charge of the country. All of a sudden, everything changes. The mass media start attacking, the mass media and the wealthy and the Jews start attacking Zuma. They start saying, oh, he's corrupt, he's this, he's that. Anyway, Zuma stays in power. I can't remember exactly until when. I think it's 2018 or so. But he stays in power, and all that time, suddenly the liberal mass media, the white Jewish liberal mass media that had been so friendly to the ANC is attacking Zuma left, right, and center, just like they attacked Trump, you know, for example. They did the same thing with Zuma for years and years, driving out investment, any nasty story that they can put out about him, they carry on and on and on as the years go by. And eventually, after all those years, they come and they say, Zuma was busy with state capture. He was going to capture the country. He was corrupt. He did this, he did that, et cetera, et cetera. And eventually, they now drive him out and a new guy comes in. When the new guy comes in, the new non-Zulu comes in, Ramaphosa, all of a sudden, it's back to business as usual. Back to business as usual. The liberals, the Jews, they're loving Ramaphosa, etc. Now, Ramaphosa himself is a very fascinating character, the current president of South Africa. He is a Venda, which is another one of the small tribes. The Vendas are a weird tribe. They're also linked to witchcraft and weird stuff. But Ramaphosa Ramaphosa is interesting because I had a Jewish friend who told me also around about 2008, he suddenly started saying to me, Jan, a very important black man has converted to Judaism.
Oh.
I said to him, oh, really? Oh, really? A black man has converted to Judaism. And understand that to convert to Judaism is not like being a Christian. It's not like you get up in the morning and you say, oh, I take Jesus to be my one and only savior, blah, blah, blah. I'm now a Christian. You don't do that with Judaism. The rabbi's got to check you. You got to do exams. They got to watch you. It's a long process, and they decide later whether they want you to be a Jew. So how is it that a black man goes through the long process to become a official convert to Judaism? And I say to my Jewish friend, I said to him, oh, okay, so if a black man's converted to Judaism and you say he's a very important black man, who is he? No, I can't tell you. On another occasion, I talked to my Jewish friend. I said, and he also brings the thing up again. He says, Jan, a very, very important black man in South Africa has converted to Judaism. And again, I said to him, just tell me. I'm not going to put it on my website. Just tell me so I know. He says, no, I can't tell you. And so I was mystified as to who this black man was. And I thought, maybe it's the guy who's the head of the Reserve Bank of South Africa. That might be the guy. It wasn't until Ramaphosa began coming back into the limelight, and he was now a billionaire. He himself had been a commie. He'd been a nobody. And in the meantime, suddenly he becomes a billionaire. And the next thing you know is he's rising. He's a rising star. And then I begin to notice things about this Ramaphosa. And eventually, in a nutshell, I did a whole video about it with photos of him and et cetera, about why I'm convinced that Ramaphosa, the president of South Africa, converted to Judaism. This must be the guy that my Jewish friend had been talking about. And you will see that Ramaphosa's surrounded by white-looking people, wealthy people. He has access to everything. They even allow him to write his own articles in the Financial Times in Britain. They allow him to write articles in white South African newspapers. He's his buddies, you see all his friends are these white looking people. And there are even photographs of him at Jewish events. There's even a whole video where he addresses a Jewish people in their synagogue, and I've put that up. So Ramaphosa is back to the Mandela Mbeki line. He is somebody the Jews approve of, and the Jews are 110% behind this Ramaphosa guy. So the only black guy who's not liked out of the four black presidents of South Africa is Zuma. Now, another thing to keep in mind is when they say to you, Zuma's corrupt, all of these people are corrupt, okay? They're all corrupt,
yeah, for sure.
Okay? Don't believe that Zuma was the only one who was not corrupt. In fact, there are non-whites who even had websites. There are non-whites, including blacks and Indians, who set up websites showing how corrupt Ramaphosa is. Mm. Ramaphosa and his brother are both billionaires. They are stinking rich and very corrupt. But guess what? The Jewish mass media never talks about the corruption and the dirt of Ramaphosa. All you ever hear is Zuma, Zuma, Zuma. So anyway, eventually they do manage to get some data on Zuma's corruption. And remember, they were saying that Zuma was corrupt back in 2008 already with smaller stuff. But you know, that's now that's the line that they're using. So anyway, what happens is they now put him on trial, and Zuma starts saying that there's a conspiracy against him, which I can believe because, like I've told you, it's a Khoza-dominated organization, and this is a lone Zulu who made it through the organization. But the communists, what the communists like about Zuma is that Zuma was always true to their cause. And their cause was to fight the whites, okay? Mm-hmm. So Zuma was always a good, let's call it a good communist, okay? So the good Zulu communist, he did his thing. He was in the war. He fought the whites. And he always fought against his enemies, the whites. So anyway, so now he finds himself on the out, and they now have a court case, and then he decides he's not going to attend. And so that's contempt of court. So he doesn't attend. I think it was in April. And so now the issue is you know, they should arrest him, etc. Eventually they decide to arrest him. But because he's a well-established figure, he's got a good following, and so the ANC itself was a little bit afraid, I think, to just go and just arrest him outright. I think they were quite stressed about this. But anyway, eventually they went through the process, and they said they're going to arrest him now. And then out of the blue came hardcore Marxist communists. In this case, the particular group is known as these are basically the Black War veterans, okay? And these Black War veterans, led, by the way, by a white communist, a white Afrikaans communist, can you believe? Anyway, they've got this white Afrikaans communist spokesman, and they came out and they said, if you arrest Zuma, you know, we're going to fight you. And they made various demands and threats, but the police came and they quickly nabbed Zuma. They don't tell you this, that this is something else that the media didn't publish. The media just said that, Zuma went and handed himself in. That's not true. Zuma never handed himself in. What actually happened, from information that I got, is that the police and the government and the security people, remember, Zuma's an ex-president, he's still protected by the state. They all arranged an operation where the cops and everybody quickly nabbed him. And probably lots of whites were involved in this, because there are lots of whites high up in the cops in some of these special units. So they nabbed him, and they quickly grabbed him at home there in KwaZulu-Natal, and they took him off to the police station. And then the liberal mass media said, he surrendered. No, he didn't surrender. He was nabbed, okay, by the government. So that is when he was quickly grabbed. But his supporters had already been building up that they were going to do stuff to protect him. Their original plan was that when the police come to get Zuma, they are going to protect him physically and stand in the way, and they'll fight the cops. But because the government did this secret operation so slick, they therefore didn't have that ability. They weren't able to stop the state. So now Zuma's in jail. Anyway, his supporters then get together, and these hardcore war veterans, the real people driving this, are hardcore war veterans as well as high-ranking people in the South African government, blacks, who are Zuma supporters. And they organized the violence that you now saw happening last month. And they have actually come forward to state what it is that they were trying to do. So as I've told you, I'm sure I've mentioned it to you in the past, that anytime the blacks do big things like this, make no mistake that this is not an accident. Blacks did, there were liberals, for example, who looked at all this looting and stuff, and they were saying, these blacks are looting because they're hungry. No, they're not. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's just liberal American bullshit. Okay. The reality is that these people organized this, and they even spread voice notes on the phones where they even told the blacks up front that they must go to loot stores. And they even told them that afterwards they must go and attack the Indian suburbs and the white suburbs in Durban. So most of the action that took place, and all of this is very interesting, because this also shows us where Zuma's real power base is. And basically, the majority of the action that took place took place in Durban, which is a port city. So Natal used to be a British colony, and Natal is where the Zulus live. The northern part of Natal was Zulu territory. So Durban is like just to the south of the Zulu territory. And Durban is the third biggest city in South Africa. So 90% of the action that took place in South Africa took place in Natal and mostly in Durban. But some of the violence did come to Johannesburg. There was violence in various places around me, but it was minor compared to the stuff that happened down there in Durban. And by the way, that clip that you played of that woman playing the piano, It looks almost like it's a white lady. Now, when I look at those buildings, I think what you're looking at there are those are places where you have private storage units. Nowadays in South Africa, because of COVID and the economy falling apart, you now have lots of businesses that no longer function. So they've taken warehouses and things and turned them into storage units. And lots of places on our storage units. And that woman probably had that piano and stuff in a storage unit. I've got another video where a white lady stands by her storage unit and everything that she'd stuck in her storage unit's been burned. And she's busy crying over it. So that's just a small portion of the massive damage that they did. Now, when I looked into this matter, these people who planned it, they say that there are 12 key people that planned this thing. One has already turned himself in. He was a black guy who was the former ambassador to Japan. So all kinds of highly politically active, well-placed blacks were behind this thing. But what I have managed to pick up is that these blacks said why they did this and what their goals were. They said that they specifically were attacking the wealthy. Why? Because they say that Ramaphosa's power base is the rich. And like I say, he's a black Jew, okay? And all these whites and wealthy whites and Jews, etc., that is why they went after the shopping malls. They went out to smash the stuff of the very wealthy. Now, the Indians of South Africa are not native to South Africa. The Indians were brought to South Africa by the British as slaves, can you believe? To my knowledge, the only slavery that I know of that ever took place in South Africa was conducted by the British. The British brought slaves from India to Natal to work in the sugarcane fields. Then later, when slavery ended, these Indians then became business people. Now, the Indians in Africa are a lot like black Jews. Okay, Indians themselves become very wealthy and they service black communities. Blacks and Indians have their own racial problems. I want to tell you that race, race is very, very real, okay? And anybody who tells you race is not real is just talking a whole lot of junk. And in Africa, you'll see the reality of race and blacks and Indians clash. And blacks have genocided Indians in other parts of Africa, what used to be German East Africa. Blacks have chased Indians out of other countries in Africa. So blacks and Indians get to a point where they clash. And they clash in a very similar way to the way whites and Jews clash. Anyway, so the Indians, most of them are in Durban, but a slightly smaller portion of them are in Johannesburg. And they also have become very wealthy. And they've done very well, especially under black rule, because with their black skins, they can get in and they can grab opportunities from other blacks. So when these people planned their attacks, they went after the shopping malls, the businesses, the industries, but then they went after the Indians because the Indians are wealthy, and then they were going to go after the whites. In total, the last statistic I heard was that 337 people died, but the vast majority of the people who died were blacks. However, there were some Indians who were killed. Up until now, everybody I've asked, and I've asked everybody that I know, not one person has been able to come back to me with an example of a white person who's died in all this violence. To my knowledge, not a single white has died. So that's good news for us. But a couple of Indians were killed, and the vast majority of the deaths were blacks. The damage done in South African rand terms was estimated, the last estimate I saw was 50 billion rand, which is almost $3.5 billion. So that'll give you an idea of the scale. They absolutely flattened warehouses, shopping malls. I'm told that the industrial part of Durban was wiped out. In Johannesburg, we didn't notice much. The area I live in is almost in the middle of all the various places where the blacks did this stuff. But anyway, the blacks, most of the stuff that took place was in the shopping malls. And then the other places where the blacks went and burnt down lots of shops was in their own areas. The blacks looted, burned, destroyed the shops in their own townships. Mm-hmm. So, and then afterwards, then people say, "Oh, we're hungry," you know. But they did it themselves. However, where things started going wrong for the blacks in all of this is that one of the places that the blacks attacked, because Durban's got so many Indians, and another thing about Natal has got the lowest. The whites in Natal are more the English-speaking whites, and the whites in Natal are the most outnumbered whites in South Africa. So you've got the white to black population ratio in Natal is the worst place in the country. So if there's a place where whites are in more danger, it's Natal. However, things actually went quite well for the whites, and I'll explain to you. The blacks, by the way, they also spent some days blocking main highways and burning big trucks. And there are a lot of Afrikaans-speaking whites who are into the trucking business, and they lost quite a number of trucks. The number I've heard is that 35 big trucks were destroyed. But the damage done to the businesses is unmatched. Nothing like this has taken place in South Africa under black rule. In fact, in all of the time of apartheid, nothing even close to this ever happened. This thing is absolutely unique in terms of its scale. They estimate that between 40 and 45,000 businesses were damaged or destroyed by this. That is how big the damage was. So, but now it comes down to, after destroying the businesses of the rich, which I don't have a problem with, because most of the businesses that are destroyed, there were some businesses that were owned by whites, but the vast majority of the businesses in the shopping malls aren't owned by normal whites, okay? These things are owned by corporations, owned by Jews, owned by the wealthy.
Yeah, it was stores and stuff like that. They were burning.
Bingo. It's exactly like that. All these chain stores all the way. All these names that are so familiar to everybody. The odd business here and there was white. They also tried to burn down some white farms, and they set fire to. Blacks have been trying in recent years anyway to try and burn down farms. And they did burn down some farms, but I don't know how many. I do know that one farm, the farmer and his family had to be rescued by helicopter because they couldn't get out. But other than that, to date, I don't know of anybody, any white person who died in all this violence. However, when the blacks then started going for the suburbs, that's when it started turning against them. In the north of Durban is a suburb called Phoenix. And Phoenix is an Indian township created in the time of apartheid. 82% of Phoenix is Indians. The blacks tried to attack the Indians. Now, the Indians, like I say, they're black, like black Jews. They're also geeky and nerdy, and they don't really do like whites and go hunting, and they don't really love guns. But there are a lot of Muslims. Lots of them, most of them are Muslims, but they are geeky Muslims, okay? Anyhow, it turns out that these geeky Indian Muslims had some security services of their own. And when the blacks tried to attack them, they fought the blacks and they killed a whole bunch of blacks. So the next thing you know is that in Phoenix, the blacks are now whining and crying. And the blacks are saying that there was the Phoenix massacre. And it's the first time in the history of South Africa, first time in the history of South Africa that Indians have killed blacks. The only death toll I know of is around about 50. The blacks are outraged by this. Then there were Indians and whites who then defended other suburbs. And it looks to me like when the blacks tried to move into the suburbs, the whites and the Indians basically defeated them. The blacks did do some damage to residences where Indians were, but on the whole, the blacks got a good whipping. The police were nowhere to be seen. The police came in late. The army came in even later. The army did virtually nothing. In fact, whites and liberals had to get the government to send the army in, and the army did nothing. They were there right at the very end and did almost nothing. So there's a period in this time, in the first 3 or 4 days, it was Indians and whites who fought back, white civilians and white security companies. And they must have killed quite a lot of blacks. They must have killed the majority of the blacks, because the police don't shoot to kill. The police use they use tear gas and rubber bullets and stuff. But the blacks are now crying about all their dead. But I will now, let me just tell you what we're looking at. What we are looking at here is a massive event that is a game changer in South African politics under black rule. As I've explained to you, Zuma, they started with the Zuma stuff in 2008. Now they've taken it to the next level. Zuma's got a 15-month jail sentence. He's got a 15-month jail sentence just for contempt of court. He can still do jail time for state capture, etc. I want to tell you where I think this thing is going. I think this is going to bring us back to the Zulus. The Zulus used to also be a warrior tribe, and they are the only tribe who actually conquered what you could call an empire in the 1800s. And these Zulus are very warrior-like, and they're very proud and nationalistic. They're like black nationalistic, okay? And I want to tell you that these Zulus, if there's any group of blacks in South Africa who can turn around and part company with the rest of the blacks, it's the Zulus. And this stuff of Zuma can very easily, if I look at the violence alone, this is already a Zulu issue. And if they go beating up on Zuma, then this can piss off the biggest and most warlike tribe in South Africa. And there are Zulus who've even spoken about secession. Now, that's not on the cards currently. The Zulus who support Zuma are still hardcore communist Zulus. They hate whites. They want to see whites killed. And so they're going to try and do their communist stuff. But give this thing time. Give this thing time. This thing can become the beginnings of a future breakup of South Africa. That's where South Africa is heading. And here is your first massive schism. And related to this, I must tell you, just as another thing, in the neighboring state of Mozambique, Mozambique is to the north of what is Zulu territory. That was the Portuguese, that was Portuguese territory. Now, in Mozambique, in the north of Mozambique, is another problem that's happening. Last year and about a year before, there suddenly was a problem in the north of Mozambique. And that is black Muslims. Suddenly, there are black Muslims in the north of Mozambique, and they are linked to the Muslims of the Middle East, etc. And they're getting guns, and they're starting to capture villages. And they start fighting the government. Can you believe that those black Muslims control a territory, a small territory in the north of Mozambique, and the government, the black communist government of Mozambique, its army could not, was too afraid actually, that's the reality, its army was unable to fight and defeat those black Muslims. Then what they did was they brought in some whites, can you believe? Including a ex-Rhodesian and a bunch of South Africans. A bunch of old white guys in their 60s and 70s who had formed a security company originally to fight poaching. They brought them in as military contractors. They gave them some small civilian helicopters. These old white men with military training were starting to shoot and kill these black Muslims in this Cabo Delgado province. Then they were the only ones who were actually able to defeat these Muslims. Even the Russians they even brought in Russian mercenaries for a time, but the Russian mercenaries were a flop. But it was the South African mercenaries who were the kick-ass ones, right? Then in March last year, these Muslims got additional weapons and they went on a big offensive, and they captured a town of like 12,000 people or so. And they also, by the way, they were busy cutting people's heads off, but they were cutting the heads off blacks. Okay. Mm. So these Muslims went on the offensive. The Mozambican army tried to fight them. The Mozambican army ran away from the black Muslims, obviously knowing that if the Muslims catch you, they're going to cut your head off. Okay. Mm-hmm. However, the old white men in their helicopters went and they recaptured the town. So the old white guys went and beat back the Muslims, killed a whole bunch of them, chased them out. But then the blacks started complaining that the old white guys are shooting too many blacks. So those old white guys then also decided to pull out of the contract with the Mozambican government. And so what's happened now is other black countries are coming in to help Mozambique. The first troops from Rwanda came in a few weeks ago, and they say they've killed some of the terrorists. South Africa is sending its first military units into the north of Mozambique. They're sending 1,500. I was already excited about the Cabo Delgado stuff last year, even before this stuff, which has me even more excited. So what I want to tell you is here are some of the things we're looking at. We're looking at the breakdown of black power in southern Africa. We are seeing for the first time a schism and a problem in Mozambique. In Zimbabwe, we already have big problems in Zimbabwe politically. Zimbabwe is already very divided politically, but the opposition in Zimbabwe just don't have guns, okay? But Cabo Delgado is a problem in Mozambique, and now we've got this Zulu thing here. And these blacks also, like these Zulus in South Africa, they are physically related to the opposition in Zimbabwe. They are actually related by the opposition in Zimbabwe. The core of the opposition in Zimbabwe are the Matabele, and the Matabele are a physical offshoot of the Zulu tribe. So you've got disaffected blacks who are now quite large chunks of the population in these black countries, and these black countries have got financial problems. They've all got financial problems, including South Africa, and you've got serious political schisms. And I think that this Zuma stuff is not going to go away. I think the long term of it is that it will turn. It might go through stages. The first stage will be a split in the ruling party itself. That's going to be a game changer. And a subsequent split or subsequent mutation could be Zulu. So I want to tell you that in the last between January 2020 and now, we've got two wars. We've basically got two wars that are not going to go away. Even though here they've arrested thousands and all the violence has stopped, the hatred and the anger is there, and it's not going to go away. We've got new things that are coming. And so all of these problems are problems that are occurring among the blacks, and the black states are struggling to keep control of their own physical territories. This means that the future has the possibility of civil war in Southern Africa. And if civil war gets serious enough in Southern Africa and groups start teaming up with each other, this whole place could eventually turn into quite a nasty war. We could be heading into, let's say, a future Middle East type situation here all across Southern Africa. What is beautiful for the whites is that we did not start any of this. And we are just sitting here and we didn't start any of this. And now all these non-whites are starting to hate each other. And this is fantastic for us. And this gives us a chance to watch, because we can come out of this. And I will tell you that I'm going to start. I've already done one video about what happened, which I'm going to put out this week. It's got tons and tons of nasty film footage. But I've kept the nastiest film footage for a subsequent video, where I want to show people the military stuff that took place, because everyone is very embarrassed. They're very embarrassed that Indians were shooting blacks. Okay. Mm-hmm. And they're very embarrassed that basically white civilians and Indians were shooting and killing blacks and were succeeding and were doing better than the police. They were doing better than the police and the government. So I want to tell you that what we've got is we've got lessons in preparation for future wars. We can actually see what they've done and how they've done it. And I must tell you that just those handfuls of whites and Indians, they were kicking the blacks' asses. The only thing was that the blacks were not armed with AK-47s, but there were some blacks who did have guns. There were a couple. But even so, this whole idea that blacks could just pour into white suburbs and destroy white homes, that did not happen. The only whites that I know of who lost their homes or who had damage to their own personal property were farmers. But the white suburbs seem to have survived totally. The Indians suffered partial damage. But as far as I know, the whites, and of course, whites lost some assets in the form of trucks and maybe a couple of businesses. But all in all, in all of this, whites came out well. But the ability of whites to defend themselves was absolutely evident in this. And so I must tell you, I'm very excited about this. Yeah. This is the beginning of our future wars and split up. And that's our opportunity in the future.
Yeah, I did see some clips of the army moving in. And, you know, it's hard to get context and clips when you see them on Telegram like that. But it was basically a helicopter crash landing. Like, four Africans flew out of the helicopter. Then the helicopter crash landed on top of them. And then, like, three Africans ran out of the helicopter with rifles. So that's what you can expect when the army moves in. in South Africa, I guess.
I must tell you, the army is out and about a bit, but yeah, you know, in terms of the threats that whites are going to face, let me describe them to you. The one threat we're going to face in the future is like these blacks in number, but armed as best they can. We could call them a militia, a mass militia. That is the one threat. The next threat, which is probably the toughest threat, will be the police, because the South African police are paramilitary. So they're not very good, but they do have the weapons and they do have the numbers. The South African police are three times bigger than the army. The army is not that big, but they got the very heavy weapons, but they're also very slow and clunky.
Is they very black as well, the army?
Yes. And you see, even the army, let's talk about the South African army in other wars. In various wars that have raged under black rule, the South African army has been forced by the United Nations, or was part of the United Nations, and went into parts of Africa, almost like up there in the Congo and places next to the Congo, to do so-called peacekeeping. And in 2012, let me tell you a fascinating thing that happened in 2012. The South African army goes up into the Congo. You've got all these wild blacks up there who've got their AK-47s, but otherwise they're wild and they're used to their wild ways and guerrilla fighting. So the South African army was up there in about 2012, 2013. And in one of those wars, there came a point where some of those blacks decided to attack a South African army base. Can you believe that they overran these blacks armed with just AK-47s and simple infantry weapons? These wild blacks overran a South African army base. Wow. And the South African army fled from them. They ran away. Okay. Yeah. And later they had to bring in like heavy, sophisticated equipment, and eventually they sort of beat them. But the whole thing was a very clunky exercise, and they don't like to talk about it because the South African army got its ass handed to it by a bunch of wild militia-type blacks, okay? Mm-hmm. So all these things are good news for whites. It's all good news. It means that one day, if we're up against trouble, you know, we do stand a chance, as strange as it may seem.
Yeah, like, there's no doubt in my mind that we can beat, I mean, millions of these people with proper white determination. Just like when we talked about Angola, you know, it can be done if the will is there. It's just if the Jews are going to be in the way and, you know, what kind of interference that will be run. But if it's just white on black, no question. You have the Battle of Blood River as an example of how things can go. If people don't know about the Battle of Blood River, I can read a little bit here. It was fought in 1838 on the bank of Nkomo River. It was what is today KwaZulu-Natal, which is what you're talking about, South Africa, between 464 voortrekkers, which is the pioneers, led by Andreas Pretorius, and an estimated 10,000 to 15,000 Zulu. Casualties amounted to 3,000 of the Zulus, including the Gingon, okay. Including two Zulu princes competing for the Prince Mpande for the Zulu throne. Three voortrekker commando members were lightly wounded. So, yeah, that's in 1838. I think we can do better now, for sure.
I must tell you exactly as you say, Andreas, that if whites have the will and the determination, and we just find our feet a little bit, tremendous things are possible. it is very possible that in my lifetime that whites could make a break for their own state. It is becoming ever more possible that this can happen, especially as these blacks start fighting. And, you know, these blacks may themselves start wanting to make a break for a state for themselves. All of this stuff can, you know, South Africa is 9 different black tribes plus whites plus Indians. So you've got like a whole bunch of people with all kinds of differences. Mm-hmm. And even in all this stuff, you know, I saw an official letter. This will be in my second video. I saw an official letter that came from Venda. You remember I said that Ramaphosa is a Venda. The Venda people, the Venda sort of ruling class, wrote a letter of apology to Zuma for what Ramaphosa is doing to him. Oh, so right. Here's this black Jew. Jeez. Here's this black Jew whacking the Zulu. Meanwhile, his own fucking tribe is saying, oh, we are so sorry. This Ramaphosa guy, he's one of us, but he's not really one of us. And he's actually, let me tell you, once, you know something, Andreas, you people in Europe, all of you in Europe, you've taken a lot of bad press for a long, long time about the fact that you've got differences between your nations in Europe, okay? That there's a problem between, let's say, Sweden and I don't know who else, Denmark or something, and Italians and French, you know, all that thing about the whites of Europe. The whites of Europe can't get along. Mm-hmm. There's something wrong with the whites of Europe. Let me tell you, my friend, that you're about to see that Europeans are well behaved compared to what can happen in Africa. Mm. In Africa, it's gonna make the rivalries and the problems of the Europeans look like nothing. And even people like the Americans who've badmouthed Europeans, wait, their time is still coming because their country is becoming more diverse. And you wait and see the problems that will come to America from their diversity. Give them 80 to 100 years, and you'll see America being torn apart at the seams. You know, all I'm saying is that everybody who's come and attacked Europeans you Europeans are going to sit and watch everybody on every other continent, and you guys are going to laugh your ass. You're going to laugh your asses off when you see what happens all across the world. That your problems will seem like nothing compared to what can happen.
Isn't it always like that? When the Jews move into an African country, they always use the tribes against each other. So they pin one tribe against the other. Like they give one tribe the ups, and then they basically mass slaughter the others.
I think in South Africa, the Jews sided with all the blacks because the Jews didn't like apartheid. So when the whites were becoming racial, the only quotes whites people who didn't like the idea of whites being racial were the Jews. So the Jews immediately started siding with all the non-whites. And that's where the Jewish position is now mm-hmm. with all the non-whites. But the problem is their gathered together alliance isn't working so well. No. And so we still stand a chance, believe it or not. We still stand a chance.
That's nice to hear. I was going to suggest a short music break. But Alan, do you have something to add before we move into a break?
Well, yeah, just in summary, it kind of sounds like Zuma's sort of this like unstable asset. Is that about why they wouldn't want him around anymore, essentially?
I think that the real issue with Zuma is that he probably is inside this causa power structure. And okay, you know, There's something I didn't tell you. Let me tell you this, because this may help to clarify why Zuma is the problem, is that Mbeki, Mandela, and Ramaphosa are financially tied back to the Jews. Zuma did something totally different. Zuma got his money from Indians. In particular, there was an Indian family from India called the Guptas who came to South Africa, and they quickly became stinking rich billionaires. So Zuma financed himself with the Guptas. So that's another reason why they go after Zuma. In fact, that may even be the core reason why they're going after Zuma. It's because Zuma's not getting his money from the Jews and the liberals. Okay, yeah. So they're like, he's corrupt. But it's only because he's not taking money. He's not dealing with the right people. The moment that you deal with the right people, you get good press.
So
part of this Zuma stuff includes the Guptas. The Guptas have actually fled from South Africa. So I actually forgot to mention probably the most important part of it was that this Zulu struck this deal with these Indians, and he was basically doing his own thing, and he was happy. So you see, if you want to lead the country and you're in with the Jews, you'll get good press. If you want to lead the country but you're not in with the Jews, you get bad press.
There we go. Yeah, that seals the deal.
there you got it.
That's usually how it goes, for sure. All right, we'll have a little break here. We can summarize this first hour by saying,
you niggas are crazy!
And we're going to move on to the next topic. But yeah, we'll be back in a few minutes. Stay tuned.
I saw where they kept the Jewish people. I saw where they kept the non-Jewish people. The only thing I've said about the Holocaust is when they tell you 6 million people died, that's a biblical reference. And it's about fulfilling a prophecy for the Jews to come home to their homeland. And they've used that reference multiple times in media well before World War II, going back all the way to the early 1900s. So that is not Holocaust denial. And the only other thing I said about World War II that people try to criticize is, yes, we know Jewish people were persecuted, we know they were killed, and it's horrible, but so were 30 million other people during World War II, so we need to remember everybody. So 6 million people didn't just die, they relocated. So when they say 6 million people, like I said, it's making reference to their biblical prophecy that says once 6 million of us perish, we will get our homeland back. Why they chose the number of 6 million, because it's written in their book.
The original number, it was 18 million, and then they wanted to be bulletproof. So they went through the records over and over.
Oh, okay, so the experts first said there were 18 million, and then the experts then said there were 6 million. So were they right when they said 18 million?
But they wanted to be bulletproof.
Oh, so they wanted to. So now, because they said they're really, really sure, that means they're 100%. The first it was 18 million. That's triple the number. Now, they're really sure that it was 6 million. Does that mean they're 100% sure?
No, but I explained
Excuse me. Some people were
counted three or four times.
That's wonderful. So does that mean that they missed any more that could have been double counted, or some people that were counted that weren't really dead? Does that mean that the 6 million number that they came up with is 100%? Can you tell me? Can we contact them right now and they're going to say the 6 million number is 100%? Or will they say it's an estimation? Will they say it's our best estimate?
Well, you know, Chris, it's sad.
I asked you a question. Will they say it's 100%, or will they say it's an estimation?
The
previous estimation was 18 million.
They believe this is the most accurate figure.
Okay, they believe, so it's not a figure.
Chris,
it's something that they are literally making up, like I said, and they're saying this is our best guess.
Greetings. This is Eric Stryker from national-justice.com. And you are listening to the Nordic Frontier, the final solution to your podcast problem.
To your podcast problem.
All right, we're back. That was a fantastic clip in that break. I just found it before the show, and I'm really into these, what are they called? The Sigma grind set videos. Have you seen these, Alan? Have you returned from the break, or am I sitting here alone, maybe?
I'm here. It sounds interesting. And I was watching it with great fascination.
Yeah.
I love it.
Now, they do like short clips of different situations, and then they say something uppity like debunk boomer propaganda with some Holocaust facts. And yeah, we should try and get that guy on. He has got some good COVID takes, and he's got some good Jew takes now as well, it seems like. And that's what you want to look like when you're on live TV talking to the Jews about the Holocaust. That's the aesthetic we're looking for. You need to be pumped as shit so that your words will weigh extra heavy when you just walk out. You're done talking. The Holocaust is a fucking joke and you just walk out of there. That's how you win that conversation. I think it's fantastic.
Nice.
So
wonderful.
Yeah, it was. I don't know. Alan, are you back? Or...
Yo, hey.
Yeah, yeah. Nice. Well, you missed the break, so we can't. You can't relate. But I'll send you the clip later. It was hilarious. So we're talking about the Africans here, and we're going to talk about Congo moving forward. The Belgian Congo, which in the beginning of the 60s, were starting to be subverted by, I'm guessing, Jews. We haven't found this out yet, but I'm guessing Jews. And this is something that I instinctively said before without any kind of basis or evidence because I'm prejudiced. And I've said this thing that all the African nations that were controlled by white people weren't just willingly given up. White people didn't just move out of there and now it's African again. All of these were tiny to very large Jewish communist interventions to play Negro tribes against each other or just whites against blacks in all these countries. Some whites fought back like we saw with the Portuguese last time we spoke about Angola. And now we're going to talk about Congo and how it happened there. And it just seems like a blueprint, and it happened somewhere starting in the late 50s, 60s, and then going all the way up to South Africa in the 90s. So, and now we have what we have. We have Congo, which is an absolute shit show. That country is just crazy. And there were stories a few years ago about these volunteers. They were like decapitated. trying to, I don't know, help out the Africans over there. They were decapitated and, you know, shown on all social media and stuff. So it wasn't, I'm not talking about the Norwegian and Danish girl that went to Morocco. This was different decapitation in Congo. I'm sure it goes on all the time. I'm watching these videos about how blacks treat other blacks in Africa all the time. And they're not nicer to each other than they are to white people. They're just absolutely fucking nasty. And it's one thing that we can see, if it's one thing that we can see with all this stuff, is that they are very good at destroying what white people built. And I know we might get into the documentary called The Empire of Dust. It's one of my absolutely favorite documentaries to do with race realism. You can see it in a very instinctive way, how it plays out through the hopelessness of trying to help or trying to work with blacks on an equal level. That's basically what it portrays. And it's brutal race realism. It's not, you know, explicit, but between the lines, and you have the famous meme of the Chinese guy that is just trying to get business done when he says, "It's all so tiresome." That's how you must feel when you're trying to help these people do anything. And there was a quote that I had. Now I've lost it because I've got memes everywhere. But it was from a white person in Africa that has experience trying to help these people and watching how blacks became self-reliant or self-reliant, black rule came into play. And he said the biggest mistake that white people can do is put themselves on the same level as the Negro. I'm not saying this as some hateful, bigoted racist. I'm just saying that when you do that, they can feel that and they will start taking advantage of that. And that's when you get South African farm murders, because they know that they have the upper hand culturally, economically, you know, propaganda-wise. So they know they can do that. The same thing goes for, you know, the relationship between the slave owner, the slave master, and the slave. It's the same thing. But it's more like, you know, just realize that you're on a different level and you have to treat them like that. So I don't know if you have something to say about that. We're going to move into the Congo business. But yeah, what do you got for us, Jan?
Yeah, you are quite right. You see, one of the things about the whites of Africa is that Africa, by the end of World War II, you know, Africa under European colonial rule was a net exporter of food. It, you know, we didn't have to import food. We produced tons of extra food, and that was one of our main outputs. So, you know, just because the whites came to Africa and made Africa look good, in the same way that whites went to America, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and took those countries and turned them into successes, okay? Just because a small group of whites came to Africa and made Africa look good doesn't mean that it's easy. And people forget that, you know, we were never more than about 6.5 million at our peak. We weren't many people, but we managed to take these people and do things with them. And yes, we were their owners, and we controlled them, and we made all the rules, and our stuff worked. But that doesn't mean that those people, when put in the same position, can do the same thing. So, you know, all this, the whites in Africa knew all along, and you, if you look at it right from the beginning, you'll see that whites were leaving Africa back in the 1950s. The moment all this talk of equality came, there's been a stream of whites, not always a big stream, but there have been whites leaving Africa all the time because they know that what's being asked of them is the impossible. It's not like we are just being malicious because it can work, but we're too greedy. No, it's because it's actually impossible. And, you know, you are quite right that once they learn things, but now, there is some good news in the sense that the blacks have also now been indoctrinated with concepts like power, political power, military power. And now that they've got power for the first time, they're also power hungry. And that's also why, like, things like this Zuma stuff, these blacks, once they start fighting each other, they even will murder each other. Okay. They even try to assassinate each other. So again, you know, if you go back to Europe and you look at European behavior and people say, oh, the Europeans this, the Europeans that, come look at Africa. You'll see the blacks murdering each other, stealing from each other, lying to each other, as they grasp greedily, very greedily, without principles for power. So, you know, once you study Africa, maybe a separate topic for another day is the World War that took place in Africa in the 1990s. That, you know, these people can fight among each other big time. And once it gets going, they make many mistakes that whites, they make mistakes that whites solved thousands of years ago. Okay. Things
like the wheel.
Let me tell you. more than that, there are concepts, there are tribal concepts and concepts that we in the West, that we European people have, there are concepts that we have in our behavior, which are unique to us, okay? And those concepts that we have are things that we've learned through lots of struggle and strife thousands of years ago. Now, there are things that blacks have not learned that our pagan ancestors knew already. Mm-hmm. Things to do with warfare and how do you solve problems between people, etc. Despite our negatives, there are many things that we do that the blacks haven't even got a conception of. Yeah. And I'm talking about behavioral stuff.
Yeah, like diplomacy.
So one of the things that you will find among them, for example, is that once they start fighting with each other, it never stops. Mm. It never stops. They can fight with each other and hate each other and kill each other for 30 years nonstop. And then you'll look at whites and you'll say, oh, but whites, you know, when we fight quickly and we get it over with. Mm. They don't do that.
Yeah.
So there are many things we do that they don't even know about. And I think Jews themselves don't even know about. I don't think the Jews are that clever either myself.
No. I found this quote, so I'm going to read it off here. It's from Dr. Alfred Schweitzer, a Nobel Prize winner in 1951. He wrote Schweitzer, The African Notebook in 1939. And he said, I have given my life to try and alleviate the sufferings of Africa. There is something that all white men who have lived here, like I, must learn and know. That these individuals are a sub-race. They have neither the intellectual, mental, or emotional abilities to equate or to share equally with white men in any function of our civilization. I have given my life to try and bring them the advantages which our civilization must offer, but I have become well aware that we must retain this status. We are the superior and they are the inferior. For whenever a white man seeks to live among them as their equals, they will either destroy him or devour him. And they will destroy all of his work. Let the white man from anywhere in the world who would come to Africa remember that you must continually retain this status. You, the master, and they, the inferior, like children, that you would help or teach. Never fraternize them with them as equals. Never accept them as your social equals, or they will devour you. They will destroy you. And that's what you're seeing when they're given free reins. That's all they do. They destroy. They don't build anything. They just destroy every single time. So it's not said in a malicious way. This is reality. And this is how we need to deal with things. That's all I'm saying. So
it's just nature.
Yes, it is.
It's like a different kind of dog, right?
Yes. It's racist.
They act a certain way and you have to behave a certain way. It's how nature functions. Whether you like it or not, you have to deal with that reality and accept it. And it's kind of strange that we can be so smart on so many levels, but for some reason we've got this block because of propaganda or ambition and hope that comes from different places. Like, well, we hope that we can bring them this religion because, you know, we think we should spread it or something like that, right? Or we hope that we can do this because we feel sorry for them. But it just feels like we lost touch with reality or with nature. And those are very wise words. And I suppose that's not too long. What long ago? When did you say it was?
1951.
Okay.
Yeah. I must agree with you guys. You know, you've got to look at humans from a natural perspective. We have to look at life from our pagan way. You know, we mm-hmm. have to look at things in a natural way, natural law. That is the only way to function. And I must tell you that if we had to function within natural law only, the way that is absolutely natural for all whites, let me tell you, we would rule every inch of this world. There's a place like Africa. I tell you, the only thing that makes me sad about Africa is that Africa is not an enormous chunk of Europe. because everything that the whites did in North America, and let's not look at the amazing feats of the whites of North America. The greatest conquest of our race were the whites who took over North America and dominated it. And now they're busy doing insane things. But that was a fantastic conquest. Now, Africa, most of Africa could be the same thing. There's no reason why most of Africa couldn't end up as a whites-only civilization. That is my dream. I must tell you, we are more than capable of it. And the wealth that exists here is beyond imagination. I don't know if you saw a little video I did about a Boer meeting, but I'm going to pull some of that video footage out anyway. I'll do a separate video just about the wealth of Africa. Guys, you have no idea how rich Africa is. In fact, where you might have seen it as well is in that video that I did about the Congo with Nordlux and Patrick. Did you see that piece where that American politician said that Africa's wealth is greater than the whole world combined?
Yeah, that's right.
And that is not a joke. You've got these people and the greatest wealth, territory, and land on the planet is in their hands, and all they're doing is breaking it. And these people are walking around like in that Empire of Dust. I mean, these people are walking around, and they're like, oh, God, you know, we're struggling to live. We don't have food. Everything's so hard. Any whites who've ever lived in Africa will tell you Africa's fantastic. Okay, you just have to look at the statistics, man. For anybody, I mean anybody, French, Germans, Italians, Portuguese, you name it, anybody who came to Africa, the Germans, when the Germans ruled German East Africa, and I'm talking 1914, before World War I. The Germans, the German colony in southwest and German East Africa was farming something like 1 million or 2 million acres of land. The whites are just – everywhere the whites have gone in Africa, they just put on their roots and they're having a ball. Even the English up in Kenya, in the north of Kenya was the Kenyan Highlands. 60,000 British farmers farmed the northern highlands of Kenya. They lived almost, it was almost like living in the Garden of Eden. It was so fantastic. Mm. And those places, once those whites were chased out of there, go to those same places today and see what's there. And there's like nothing there. Nothing's going on there. But when whites were there, it was awesome. That if for me, the only thing that went wrong with us in Africa was too few whites came to Africa. Whereas like 100 million or more went to America, only 6 million came to Africa. But we've got territory here like you have no idea the wealth that's sitting here. If we could just double or treble our population, I'm telling you, we'd be as rich as hell. And we could be an outpost. We could be like a military outpost for Europe and the West.
Yeah,
need to get like 10 or 20 million people here.
The thing about the native blacks as well, they wouldn't be a billion blacks if we didn't feed them and didn't give them medicine. I mean, they could live there in the, I don't know, millions, hundreds of thousands. Like, how small were these tribes 200 years ago? I mean, the population explosion in Africa is only because we've fed them and given them modern medicine and all that stuff. So I don't think that's a problem either. It's a very big continent. So the only problem is, I usually say...
I'm a Jew.
I think is...
Jewish!
what usually goes around and just mucks everything up. We could sort this thing out. And there's no doubt in my mind that it's, you know, wealthy. I mean, that's obviously so. And it's huge.
Well, what are the Chinese doing there, right?
Yeah, Jesus Christ.
They're trying to get in on that. They need all those medals and stuff for their production.
Yeah, that's right.
All the computers and the shit.
But let's move into the Congo and see what happens. If we take it from the beginning, kind of when it was starting to be dissembled, and yeah, what happened in the late 50s, okay, early 60s in Congo?
Okay, basically in the Congo, what you had was you had the beginnings of the conflicts that the Soviet Union, the Jewish Bolshevik Soviet Union, was getting up to. They had already all these wonderful Western allies, the Soviet Union, they actually had as their top priority after World War II. But they'd already decided in the late 1920s, actually. Stalin had already said that they need to start supporting non-white movements around the world, because their goal was to destroy all the European empires, including the British Empire. So they actually prepared all these political parties all around the world, even in Asia, Africa, South America, Latin America, and they were looking for the chances to now push for this so-called democracy. So back then, democracy and nationalism were good, as long as it's not whites, okay? So if non-whites want democracy and nationalism, it's good. And so that is the bogus method by which these blacks started pushing for power. They first started in Kenya, which was a British colony. The British fought them in Kenya for a time, but the British realized that they could never defend their empire, so the British quit. However, when the British fought in Kenya for about 8 or 10 years, then they handed it over to the very blacks that they'd been fighting against. So then they handed it, oh, you're free now. And, you know, and then the British made a decision, and that's the decision that unleashed all hell. In 1960, Macmillan came to South Africa, and he gave a speech in the South African Parliament called The Wind of Change. And he said, there are winds of change blowing through Africa, and it's going to change now. And the British Empire basically overnight released all its colonies. Within 2 or 3 years, it released all its colonies, handed it over to the blacks, and the British got the fuck out of Africa, okay? Mm. But it was only the British who were such useless bastards, okay? Meanwhile, the Portuguese, the Belgians, the French, everybody else was not so keen on this idea of just abandoning Africa. And so the place where the blacks made their next move was in the Congo. Now, there are two very, very wealthy parts of Africa in concentration. The one is South Africa, and the next one is the Congo. These two chunks of territory are unbelievably minerally rich. So the Soviets tried to move in on the Congo. The problem with the Congo for the Belgians was a massive territory. The Congo is enormous. I don't even know if the Congo is almost the size of Europe. If it's not the size of Europe, it's freaking close to the size of Europe. And you had only 100,000 whites there, and you had 11 million blacks there. So the whites were outnumbered. The whites were outnumbered 100-1. The blacks then suddenly overnight turned on the whites, started massacring them, etc. Even so, the Belgians started wanting to fight back. But then the United Nations came in on the side of the communists and the Soviet Union. Rest assured, Jews involved in all this. And the next thing is the United Nations tells the Belgians to get out of their own colony, as crazy as that may seem. And the Belgians weren't keen on it. And the United Nations basically started sending armies, including even forces from Ireland and Sweden and so forth, to now come in. And it started trying to occupy the Congo. But what happened was the wealthiest part of the Congo is the southern portion called Katanga. And as the Belgians were pulling out, there were still whites living in the Congo who decided to move to the south, to Katanga. And then you also had the other white-controlled countries in southern Africa, like South Africa, Rhodesia, the Portuguese. And they started warming to the idea that in Katanga, there was a black guy who was willing to make a stand for the Western world. His name was Chombi. And so suddenly the whites who live in Africa and the whites who are in the Congo all start backing Katanga. So Katanga starts becoming a resistance, a country that's going to secede from the Congo, and it's going to be pro-Western. You would have thought the United States would like this, but they didn't. And you then actually had the United Nations engaging in a war against Katanga in bits and pieces to actually seize Katanga. Meanwhile, the rest of the Congo was ruled by a black communist, and the black communist could kill anybody he wanted to kill, do what he wanted to do. United Nations said nothing about it, but they really tried to get rid of Katanga. In Katanga, you even had Rhodesians and South Africans and others fighting on the side of the blacks, but eventually Katanga collapsed, etc. And the Belgian government itself even started supporting Katanga. So what is the tragedy about Katanga is that although you had this black-ruled country, it still had white civilization, white industry there. And if the United Nations and the United States had not actually invaded Katanga, that could have been the place where all the whites of Southern Africa and the Belgians could perhaps have stopped the Soviet Union. We could have stopped it right there. It's very possible. But as usual, politics and diplomacy, which are basically Jewish scams, saw to it that eventually we lost Katanga. And later after, but Katanga and the Congo is so weird that after Katanga was brought back by force into the Congo, Chombi was made the prime minister, the president, I think, or prime minister for a year and a half. During that time, he again called on white mercenaries from South Africa and Rhodesia to come and to kill some more communists, and they did come and do that. Whites were always keen to fight black communists. We never had a problem. Mm-hmm. But the West is, you know, Andreas, the Anglo-American West is so weak. I can't stress enough how we need European thinking. Europeans are tougher. Europeans know how to stand their ground in a place. Europeans are colonizers and explorers. America was the white Americans are okay at colonizing America, but they seem to be incapable of functioning outside of America. Whereas Europeans don't have that problem. That is just a fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
You know, America as the leader of the West, you know, wouldn't it be so much better if Hitler's Germany was the leader of the West? We wouldn't have any of these problems, none of them.
Yes, if only we spoke German. I think that's the meme. That would have been great.
Oh, that's lovely. I like that.
Well, they always say at least we're not speaking German, right? Mm. Then they show you a picture of London. At least they're not speaking German. London's a shithole.
I've seen that, and I totally agree with that. I totally agree. You know, I was on a show with some British guys, right-wingers, the other day, and I still sense in them that hatred for the Germans and the hatred for Hitler, and I'm afraid that those things will be things that will burn them for a long, long time. They just are still in that mindset, you know, that evil has come out of Europe, and it's rubbish. It's just junk.
Yeah, it's really deep in some people. The Polish and the English and other peoples. They have a hard time getting over the brainwashing there.
Yeah. So with regard to your Empire of Dust, I didn't watch the whole thing, and it was simply due to time that I didn't get to watch the whole thing, but I watched chunks of it. And I thought that the Empire of Dust was it's what you see in the Empire of Dust is very similar to what the rest of Africa is like. Zimbabwe and all those places, even South Africa, because once the blacks are in power, the blacks now make the rules. And now you are talking to another people who are making rules, and they don't think like we do. They've got all kinds of built-in problems. They've got their own corruption. They've got all their nonsense that they get up to. So in Africa, for example, to function in many of these African countries, what they don't tell you is that to function in most of these African countries, you basically have to go and find the highest ranking politicians that you can bribe. If you bribe them, then they'll say, yeah, you can do this, you can do that. I just need my 20% cut on all your business deals, you know. Mm-hmm. That is how most of Africa actually functions. So that Chinese guy who's trying to get these things done, and that's another thing about whites and the blacks. Whites are like a natural energetic people. You might not think so because you all live among each other and you think everyone's like you. And trust me, they aren't, okay? These blacks, if the blacks are left to themselves, they try to do things slower and slower. And I'm not kidding you. And the more you leave them, and the more you leave them to settle down to their comfortable pace, the slower they will go, okay? We are different. We're like energetic.
Yeah, and I've seen it in America, and it gets so bad that it's like they don't want to work at all. Like they do the absolute bare minimum. You know, they just go to the office to get their food stamps, and that's it. And life should be as easy and work free as possible. So
exactly. Now let me tell you, you know, and what I'm going to say is somewhat nasty, but we were talking about nature and natural law. You know something? If I look at all those people and the pain and suffering that they are in, which is of their own creation, and their own pain and suffering to live in this world, maybe they shouldn't be in this world. You know, because for us, they are suffering and complaining in situations we wouldn't complain in. I actually wrote a little thing that I published on my website the other day. I actually turned around and I said to people, I wrote a little piece called White People Never Got Free Lunches. And I said there, go and read the history of Europe, okay? Go and read the history of Europe and see the suffering that white men have lived through. You know, go and look at Napoleon's armies. Go look at the Wehrmacht. Go and look at how many thousands and thousands of white men froze to death and died in the most hideous, painful ways. Their limbs were dropping off their bodies, okay? And go into pagan times. And in pagan times, you'll see even more horrific things, how white men have died. And the struggles of whites in pagan times. And then go and show me blacks and Jews. Go and show me blacks and Jews who died, who lived and died in the same terrible way that many white men did. You will not find that. You will not find that. And everything that we have, we've fought for. Everything we have, we've fought for. There's not a white nation out there that hasn't had to, through blood, sweat, tears, pain, suffering, and extreme hardship. There's not a white nation there's not a single nation in Europe that didn't go through extreme pain. There's not a white nation outside of Europe that didn't go through pain and suffering. And all these other people, they just want everything for free. If they had to do what our people did, they wouldn't take a fraction of the suffering that our people have been through. Yeah. I mean, look at the fire bombings of the Germans. Show me where anybody has done to blacks what has been done to whites. It doesn't exist. Our people have had the nastiest things done to each other, and we don't sit and cry about everything. But we can show the nasty things. These things these blacks did where they're burning down all this stuff here in South Africa. Show me when at any time in the history of Africa, whites did the same thing to blacks. We could have done this under apartheid. We had a military force. We could have gone into their townships and killed everybody by the millions. We could have killed them all, but we didn't. So, you know, and now these people hate us. You know, when I look at all this teaching of them, Christianity, trying to Christianize them, trying to Westernize them, teaching them stuff, I must tell you, we wasted our time.
Yes.
We wasted our time. You know what we should be doing? We should have as many children as we possibly can and focus our attention on our children. That's the only sane thing to do. And these people, I mean, in that empire of dust, that Chinese guy, he's just trying to do his thing and he can hardly get a fucking thing done. But that is how most of Africa functions. And amazingly, despite that unbelievable level of disorganization and inefficiency, these people are still able to, they still have large amounts of money because Africa's stinking rich. The only thing that's keeping Africa going is the sale of those raw materials. The super rich and the sale of those raw materials, that's the only thing keeping these billions of people going.
The thing is, with those industries that they look at in the Empire of Dust, like buying gravel or whatever they're trying to do, they're making railway, they're making roads. If you just replace those guys like with a fraction of white people, they would get that thing done. And even if you'd replace them with Chinese people, but, you know, they would just get it done. Whereas they hire like 20 blacks to stand around and do fuck all day long, just hoping that they would work correctly, but they don't. And it's the same thing when we have them here. We have 10 to 20 blacks assigned to cut lawns and fix bushes and all that stuff. You have to have one white guy that goes around and tells everyone in detail what they're going to do all day long. Otherwise, they won't do it. They'll get any chance to not do any kind of work. And then you have another example of, just a simple example of white people settling up here in the north. I have yet to see a racial stranger living in a house in the woods, you know, clearing his own snow and, you know, building his house, doing all this stuff. It doesn't exist. They all live in the cities and they're all subsidized to survive. If we just left them alone, they wouldn't survive. They couldn't hack it. And that's after generations. Could be like three generations Africans in Sweden. They just can't do it. They're not built for it. So
it's very fascinating to hear your first-hand stories that it's starting to sound like Africa there by you, right on your doorstep.
It is Africa in town, yeah, for sure.
And the stuff of the snow. I mean, we come from ancestors who lived in glaciers. I mean, our ancestors lived through a nightmare, whereas look at the people who came. The humans who came out of Africa. Africa was always a good place to live.
Yeah, no hanging fruit.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And in that sense, you know, we are a people who come from extreme hardship. That is actually our history. Our whole history is a history of struggling and strife of intensity. And it's formed us and it's honed us. And now here is everybody telling us how evil we are. No, we're not evil. We functioned in line with nature. It was that or death. And we are what nature approves of. And we shouldn't be, you know, we shouldn't be listening to Jews or anybody else. We've walked paths. I mean, these Jews and their fake history of existing for 3,000 and even more fake history of existing for 6,000 years since the creation. I mean, whites have existed at least for 45,000 years in Europe. I mean, you know, how is it that others can tell us what to do? We, the creators and inventors of almost everything.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's the mindset that you should have. The Sigma mindset, grind set. Very nice. And did we finish off on Congo? Did you have anything else to add? That the UN were assholes and they went in and basically massacred whites and Africans the same just to have their little plot?
All I will say is that the United Nations obviously didn't feel that they got that much done. They didn't try that stuff again in Africa. But what a mess. We did have the United Nations back a little bit in Africa, and they do still stick their noses in the northern parts of Africa. The good news is that on the whole, the United Nations attempts to bring peace in Africa and to do things has been a failure, and that for the most part, the blacks even start hating each other. So it's not worked out well. And that was a really dumb thing that they did to the Belgians. The Belgians, if the Belgians had been left alone, when I look at the Belgians and I think, if the Belgians had been left alone, despite being massively outnumbered, etc., I think the Belgians would have started putting up some kind of a fight along the lines of the Portuguese, maybe not as intensely. But if I look at the Belgians, they were never at any time lacking confidence. They had an army and they were able to bring in good troops quickly. And the Belgian government never at any time expressed a desire to lose its colony. So the loss of the Belgians was a loss for us. It, you know, between the Belgians and the Portuguese, maybe we'd have kept, a most important chunk of Africa.
Yeah, but it's crazy that
maybe have stopped them.
Such a small country would own like massive Congo. That's a big place. But it said here, even in the Wikipedia, it says that says two Hammarskjöld, which is Dag Hammarskjöld. I don't know if you mentioned him, the Secretary General of the UN at the time, about the secession of Katanga, that it was an internal Congolese matter, and the UN was forbidden to intervene by Article 2 of the United Nations Charter. They broke their own fucking human rights bullshit laws to do this. So it's a big deal. Congo was a big deal because, yeah, it was disgusting. And it's, you know, on Wikipedia, the most Jewish information center there is. So they're admitting it themselves and no one gives a shit. Does anyone know about Congo being subverted by the UN? No, I don't think so.
Yeah, we could almost say that Congo is the first time the whites of Africa, the white Europeans in Africa, were fucked over. That's like the first fuck over, you could say.
Yeah, and they obviously realized that it was one of the biggest money cows that there was on the continent, so they went for it. Well, Stalin and the Soviets. So, yeah. Maybe we can take this opportunity to round it up. It is about 11 o'clock. It is getting late in the land of the Nords. And it has been a very fascinating tales from Africa once again. So do you have any final words or things you want to close up with before we say goodbye for this time?
Yeah, I'm busy. I'm busy with some other videos that have got bearing on some of these things. I want to return to doing some military stuff, especially doing some military analysis of what happened here in Natal and so forth, because very interesting stuff. There is something that I've just put out about Professor Quigley, from America. The white right always focuses on Quigley and his writings about conspiracies and his links to the elite, etc. Mm-hmm. But I put out a thing that I think you guys might find interesting, and I'd like to urge all whites to look at it. Quigley Quigley's, among his students were Bill Clinton and many others, okay, famous people. But Quigley spent 30 years lecturing in America on the concept of the evolution of civilizations. He was trying to do something that Europeans previously had done, and the liberals in America believed that Quigley was the greatest of all time, like the greatest intellectual. I put out a video that's a summary of that, where I go into the because I went and read the whole thing last year, and I do a summary of it, because in there you will see errors in his work, and there are very interesting concepts in there that could be of great use to us, even in understanding our own future and what we could do. But I also point out the errors in there, because errors in Quigley could be the very reason why America is being flooded by non-whites and why that is being done to you Europeans. But you got to understand the things that are sitting in Quigley. And maybe that is something that we could discuss again another day. But I'd urge you to take a look at it. And another thing I was looking at that somebody discovered for me was somebody discovered an amazing thing about that basically boils down to white socialism. But it's white socialism right now. Somebody's doing it, and they're doing it very well. And I'm not going to mention a word about it. I just want to finish this other stuff, and then I'll finish my white socialism video. I urge whites to look at that. I think that those of you who are national socialists, when you see this particular model, I want to tell you, I was looking at this model. This could work in South Africa. This could seriously work in South Africa, and this can work in the future for us. And it's whites who live like that right now, but they are small communities and you don't know about them. And I must tell you, I was blown away by what I was shown. These are communities, but they are not national socialists. They got religious reasons for living how they live, but you must look at their output. I want to tell you that if all whites everywhere lived like this, we would be the strongest superpower in no time at all. And I'll leave you with one thought, that do you know that it is physically possible to double our population every 20 years? The white population could be doubled every 20 years. It's physically possible, but you got to live in a certain way. And when you see the numbers of children that these people have and the wealth that they generate and how they live, you won't believe what they can do. If that's the model, we won't have a numbers problem. So that's nice. Something else.
Sounds like a white.
The moment I put it, I'll give it to you. I'm telling you, my conclusion about Africa and race and all that is simply this. After looking at how we've lived, and we've lived close with these people, we've controlled them, we've had them in large numbers, etc. I'm going to tell you, we must get the hell away from these people, stick to our own kind, stick together as a race, and we must have children like there's no tomorrow. There's no such thing as too many white children. No such thing as that. You can't have enough children. And, you know, I can't believe what I'm saying, because when I was young, I never even thought like this. Now, I would now even say things that would be anathema to what I was when I was young. Nowadays, I'd even say, get married as soon as you can.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Go do like ancient times. Get married when you're 16 years old. Move on. That is actually the best way to live. But wait until you see my video, because it's modern examples and it'll hit you in the face. It was the greatest white pill I've seen ever. It's good. So good stuff.
Looking forward to that. All right, Alan, do you have anything closing thoughts on Africa, or did you enjoy story time?
Yeah, very much so. Thanks, Jan, so much. And I got the email about your Quigley video, so I'm looking forward to watching that.
Brilliant. Once you guys have watched it, you see, because Quigley's got concepts in there. They're concepts you need to understand first, like tension of development, instruments, instrument of expansion, institutions. Once you understand those concepts, then we can talk, because then you can see that there are good things in Quigley and then there's junk in Quigley. Like Quigley doesn't mention race ever. And when he does mention race, he does the most bizarre things imaginable. And that can only be because of the eras in America where you had those Jews and people like Boas who wrote race out of science. Mm-hmm. So then he does a weird thing. And when you see those things that's in there, then go and look at what's happening in politics today and tell me if you're not seeing Quigley. There are many examples. For the Americans always talking about the swamp. Oh, there's the swamp that needs to be drained. Go and read Quigley and you'll see that Quigley explains to you what this he explains to you that you've got to have two political parties, but they mustn't be too different. He tells you everything that is the way that things are today. He tells you, and he wrote it down in 1961. And when you read him, you'll understand the concepts. But then afterwards, you'll say, okay, which of these things are correct? Where did he make his mistakes? There's good and bad in Quigley. He's a very strange character. But the liberals take Quigley as a god. And they take him exactly correctly. They say he's right about everything. But one of his biggest mistakes was race. And you'll see what he did wrong with it.
Yeah, that sounds good. I'm going to check it out. And if people want to check your work out, you can find it on History Reviewed. HistoryReviewed.best is what you're doing now. So check that out.
I've actually got multiple domains. There's historyreview.best, historyreview.com. The reason I had multiple domains was because they took some of them down. Actually got multiple domains, but they point to the same place. But yes.
Yeah, we're all plagued by the same censorship and the constant deflections and having to work to have our work stay up online. That's part of it, part of the business. But yeah, check his stuff out. There's a lot of videos there. And check this one about Congo out. The documentary that's included in your video is worth the watch. You get first-hand information, I would say. So very nice. So thank you for listening, everybody out there. It's nice to be back on the show. And we'll be coming back now regularly every Tuesday at 8 o'clock. We might actually hit 8 o'clock every Tuesday now that there's an office. We'll see about it. And next week, a very exciting packed show. We have to catch up with all the COVID shit and all the funny business that's been going on all summer. So look forward to that. And I also have some guests in the pipeline. So if you want to stay in touch, get on Telegram. It's the best way to reach us. It is a Nordic Frontier podcast. It's the main channel. And the chat channel is Nordic Frontier Chat. We also have the Nordic Resistance Movement on there, the content channel, where you get all the posts from the NordicResistanceMovement.org. And we also have the big chat channel, Nordic Resistance Movement, which is for everyone that is supporting the movement worldwide. Except Jews, of course. But with that, I'm going to tune out into the night. And here we go. So if you have any questions to the show, you can send them to nordicfrontier@protonmail.com. I have been a bit backlogged on the emails. I'm going to try and reply the ones that I remember. But if you haven't had a reply, you had an important question, you can send it again and I'll try and reply. So with that, I say see you next Tuesday. Don't be an English cigarette and hail victory.
Hail victory.
Hail victory.
So for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed. all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too. Energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. Thank the whites, thank the whites.